big shout out goes to Maxxis Tires, Jensen USA, and Fox Shocks for supporting the Inside Line. Welcome, mountain bikers.
Well caffeinated. We'll see if we can keep our thoughts in check.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for the coffee. The espresso.
I know.
This isn't the icebreaker, but give us a little info on what you made for us.
Yeah, so I brought my whole coffee setup. I nerd out pretty hard on coffee stuff. So for my coffee press, I have a Flair, which is a full manual press. And then I have a Breville stovetop steamer to steam milk and a 1Z Presso hand grinder. So it's all pretty premium products. So I think the whole setup, it's like full, no power, anything. It's still probably like $500 or $600 for everything.
I was going to ask, how much is it? $500 or $600?
Probably when you like add everything up. Yeah, it's around there.
Crazy.
So, and then, yeah, we got some Captain and Stoker beans. This is a coffee shop up in Monterey, which if people have been to Sea Otter and you've tried to get good coffee in Monterey, you've probably been to Captain and Stoker. Okay. So, the dude who runs it, it's him and his wife, Tyler and Kelsey. And Tyler's like a sick BMXer. He actually, I think he knows Dakota Norton. I want to say they both grew up in Michigan. And
sense.
He was like a BMXer and then now lives in Monterey, has this coffee shop and is like a Canyon ambassador as well. And just like rips on a bike and just got
funny.
Was like never into coffee, got super into coffee. And then now he's got a coffee shop and that's like his life is coffee. So. Yeah, they hook it up with coffee, and I think we're going to be doing a signature roast together. So,
oh, that's neat. For
that. Yeah.
So, what's that entail?
Yeah.
I don't know. It'll probably be some sort of blend. I tend to like kind of like fruitier, like lighter roasts. So, we'll kind of come up with a blend, and then I think the thought is to maybe I'll try and make some coffees for people at the BMEs this year. That's kind of the series I'll be following. So maybe try and give some coffee away and make some people coffee and just get people stoked on like, coffee.
Make it out of your van or?
Yeah, just like make it out of the van.
Sick.
So we'll see. I might have to upgrade to a electric grinder. I don't know about hand grinding like 15 coffees. That'll be pretty gnarly.
That's sweet. That's your warm up.
Yeah, right. I'll be nice and warmed up. Get the heart rate up before going out for a long day.
Get arm pumped before you can drop in.
Yeah.
I'm going to ditch my sweatshirt.
All right. I'm down to nerd out about coffee. Like I don't care. Like the YouTubers will be like, they'll be out a minute and a half. What? Yeah. You didn't talk about something technical about mountain bikes? I'm not going to watch, but the site people are down. So how do you get a coffee that's fruitier? Like, do you put actual essence, which we talked about essence the other day?
Yeah. So most of like the fruitiness of coffee comes from like how it's processed. So like when it's picked, like when you pick coffee from like coffee plants, it has like it's essentially like a fruit and then the beans inside. And so like the way that they either like dry the coffee, I guess just like the way they process it brings out like different notes in the coffee. And then the way it's roasted too, like when you have darker roasts, which are more traditional in like Europe, just I would say like lower end coffee tends to be like dark as well. They kind of like burn out a lot of those tasting notes you get, and then they supplement it with just like adding sugar for sweetness. But you can get like a lot of natural sweetness out of coffee just by like roasting it a certain way and the way it's processed and stuff. So yeah.
Cool.
I don't know a whole lot about coffee like harvesting and all that stuff. I've done like a little bit of research into it. There's like different processes, like I think it's written on this one, this one process cold water, anaerobic, natural. I have no idea what that means. Natural is like the process. I don't know what cold water anaerobic is. Yeah, I don't know. So
you know more than us.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot more.
I mean, there's
making it all up.
I mean, I'm sure people know there's like, you can go down some YouTube rabbit holes. Mm-hmm. So I definitely go down the coffee YouTube rabbit holes.
I bet.
Yeah.
How did that even start? Like when, how'd you get so deep into coffee?
Yeah. I don't know where it started.
Cause we all drink coffee, but like,
yeah,
probably most of us are simpler than not.
Like I said, I've got my bagged decaf Starbucks and like a Mr. Coffee brewer thing. Like you weren't offended though, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. At the end of the day, it's just like dirty bean water, really. But like, I don't. Yeah, I guess it kind of started. I didn't really like coffee growing up. Probably like most people don't. And then, I come from like an Italian background, so like coffee's pretty deep in the like Italian culture. And my parents always had like an espresso machine, and then I kind of started just like messing around with that thing. Better Buzz, like coffee shop down in San Diego, like started hooking me up with coffee. Tim Langdon's the owner, and he's the one who started that spot. And now it's grown to like, I think over 10 or 15 locations. It's like fully blown up. Anyway, so like he kind of got me started with like some better coffee, and I kind of like learned a bit through Better Buzz, and then just kind of started like doing my own research and like finding what I liked about coffee, and then trying to pour good latte art is like a whole thing.
Latte,
I don't know.
Latte art?
Is yeah.
Yeah. Like in the foam?
Yeah. And like the foam. It's just like you make a little like art piece every morning and then you just destroy it by drinking it. But like something about like the process of like making something like, I guess, drinkable art in a way. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So, yeah. It's just like a fun way to start the morning. And like some mornings I'll just get like frustrated that the milk's not like textured properly, just like the pettiest first world problems. But yeah, I don't know.
Does it ruin your experience? Is it kind of like bikes, like where you can get so technical down rabbit holes that it's not even fun anymore?
Sometimes it'll get like that. Usually I'll just kind of be like, yeah, I guess, yeah, there's definitely been times where I've just gotten like so frustrated with like stuff not working. Like even that steamer I have, when I first got it, I like could not get it to steam correctly. It had like a ton of really wet steam, so I was making like these huge air bubbles. And I found like this Australian dude on YouTube. He's like, yeah, drill like two holes here, two holes back here, and then like open it, let it purge out all the wet steam, and then close it. And then it's been like perfect. So I feel like, yeah, it's kind of like bikes. It's like if you feel like something's wrong with like your, it's usually like suspension or like tire pressure or like, I don't know. Any sort of thing that people kind of like start to go down rabbit holes with, you can kind of do the same with coffee. So I feel like there's like tons of parallels with like setting up a bike and then like setting up like a coffee to go through an espresso.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm like, I come from, my dad's like an engineer. He like designs hard drives. My mom's like, she's a yoga teacher now, and she's always kind of been more artistic. So I feel like bikes are kind of like that. They're like very engineering heavy, mm-hmm. but then like at the end of the day, the engineering only gets you so far, and you have to be like, yeah, the artist on the bike trying to like do what you want the bike to do and like find your lines down and like be creative. Mm-hmm. And I feel like coffee's that way. Cameras are that way. So I think I'm just like, I tend to be pretty connected with stuff that's like has an engineering background and then like art, I guess, involved with it too.
For sure.
So yeah, I feel like bikes, coffee, and cameras and are kind of all that way. So Sweet. Maybe that's the parallels that I draw between them all. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
I love it. Yeah. We just started off so deep.
Yeah. We're going to get into all of it. That's good.
Thank you for coming by. Yeah. This has been great.
Caffeine's starting to hit too. So
I know, right? Yeah.
We'll get all jabbery.
Exactly.
Good time. All right. I'll rattle off an official intro and we'll technically get started here.
Sweet.
Welcome, mountain bikers. Thanks for tuning into the Inside Line podcast. Jason's got to turn off his phone.
Mine's so, off. We're on Do Not Disturb.
Sweet. I'm Sean Spoer. We got Jason Schroeder turning his phone off. I'm stoked to have our guest today, Mr. Luca Cometti. Thanks for coming on. Stoked to be here.
Thanks for having me. I've been an Inside Line listener. I think you mentioned the other day, it's been like 4 or 5 years now.
This is our sixth.
Sixth year, yeah. So like, I think I remember listening to like the first episode because you guys were like pretty early to like the mountain bike podcast game.
Yeah, I think we got a little bit of a jump. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I definitely remember like listening from, I don't remember what the first episode was, but I definitely remember listening to like the first episode.
Yeah. Elliot Jackson was the very first
Elliot
one.
Jackson, yeah. That's right. Uh-huh. Okay, so, cool.
Yeah.
And it's cool. Like even sponsor wise, there's been sponsors from like day one. Yeah. Which is cool.
Yeah. So. Dude, look at that plug. Jensen USA, coupon code inside line, all one word to check out, 10% off. Yeah. Max's tires.
I like rattled off like the whole Jensen USA thing because I've heard the podcast so many times. I think it's like ingrained into my memory now. So.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah, Jensen USA, this guy's doing good work.
Yeah. Sweet. Thanks, man. Thanks. All right. This is the icebreaker we're going to start with, and we're going to avoid the tray table discussion, the tray table knob that I've been so hot on because it's kind of getting burned out. I got a text this morning from a former colleague who works at your bicycle frame sponsor, and he dropped the knowledge that in your contract, you get a bonus if you beat Kyle Strait in dual slalom. Is that true?
I don't know if that's actually in the contract. But I, it might be. He might have slid that one in there. I don't actually know.
Do you read your contracts?
I do, yeah. But I don't know if that's actually in there. It could be. But I feel like if you're beating Kyle in a slalom, you're probably getting on the podium anyways. So
there's
a bonus there regardless.
Okay. And then he went on. This is Scott Hart, by the way. He went on to say that you versus Kyle is a pretty significant talking point because, according to his memory, he didn't know if this was true or not, but when you and Kyle have gone up against each other, have you ever lost against him? He seemed to think no, but no, maybe once.
I've definitely lost against Kyle, but I've never lost against Kyle at national champs. Mm. Well, not in like a finals round of national champs. I think there's been... So I think I've won slalom national champs 3 times as a professional, and 2 of those times was against Kyle.
Hmm.
And yeah, it was funny. A couple of years ago, we were at the bike swap meet down in San Diego, and I had like a bunch of old jerseys, and like one of the national champs jerseys slid in there. And we were all like set up selling stuff, and he's like, "Dude, what is this thing?" It's like, "This is your national champs jersey?" He's like, "This dude's trying to sell off his national champs jersey. I can't even get one myself."
Did he buy it?
I was like,
"You're like, I'll give you a good deal."
Yeah. No, yeah. But yeah, it was funny. Just like, yeah, I should have sold it to him. No, he needs to get one day. I feel like it's like PD with like world champs. Like he just had to get one. Just like mm-hmm, Kyle with like slalom national champs. Like he needs to get one of these days.
It's surprising
he's
that
always
he
so close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and he's like the solemn guy now.
Yeah.
I mean, he has his own event. He has the sickest track at his house.
Like, yeah, he's like the U.S. slalom president, so.
Yeah. Not president of slalom.
President of slalom, for sure. I mean, he's like building the Sea Otter track this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going to put on another race at Big Bear, and then I think GoPro Games is going to go again. They kind of helped with that last year.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, it's cool. They're like really making a push. I know Kyle was like, he was always fed up with Crankworks because he was always like, okay, what's like the prize purse? He's just always kind of felt like athletes weren't getting enough prize money from Crankworks. And so he was kind of like, F you guys, I'm going to put on my own slalom series. And like, there's going to be more money in this one than there is like at your guys' Crankworks stops. So, which I don't think the Crankworks money is necessarily that bad. But like, yeah, last year at Kyle's and yeah, Rachel's slalom event at Big Bear, they had, was it like a $20,000 prize purse or something?
That's crazy.
It was something
like, I think the winner
huge.
Got like $5,000 or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, that sounds right.
For like I mean, it's not a local slalom race, it's like mm-hmm. a national slalom race, but still for like, yeah, just like a one-off slalom event, like in the US, pretty insane. And mm-hmm. it's like open to all categories too, which is cool. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. No, it is sweet. And we need to go to that.
Yeah, for sure. You're down here now. Like,
I know. I don't have an excuse now, but.
Yeah, going back to Scott Hart, like he raced last year. Like Scott loves slalom. So it's cool.
He
like,
loves it. He gets so amped, like custom bikes, like tweaks his bike out everywhere. Yeah.
Oh, he's asking me like setup questions all the time. And he's like, oh, what do you think about this and that? And yeah, like at first, when I switched to Canyon, I initially started with like a 27.5 Spectral and tried to short shock it. And I think my bottom bracket was at like 11 inches. And I just like went, I flew like straight to Rotorua with this bike. Like never really rode it. I think I rode it like one day and I was like, whoa, well, we're in, we're committed. And so, because it was short shocked, I think I was doing speed and style as well. And there was, there's like the airbag out there that you mm-hmm. can go and ride ahead of time. And I remember trying to do a front flip and like to do a front flip, you like really got to sit into like the back wheel mm-hmm. and kind of like throw it forward. And I sat in so hard that like the seat stay actually hit the rear tire. That's like how short shocked it was.
Whoa, really?
Yeah. And then I went to race and it was just like not right. It was just like way too low. Mm-hmm. Like it cornered sick, but then like pedaling, I was just like always scared to pedal strike. And so I was like, all right, ditch this thing. And then now the last, I guess, 2 years, I've been running the Neuron, which is technically...
It's like their XC bike kind of, right?
It's like a light trail bike. It's like a 130 mm-hmm. bike. And it's 29, but I just put 27.5 wheels on it, and it actually works killer. Huh. I run some, like, short 165 cranks that actually, like, grinded the ends down to, like, have even a little more clearance.
No way.
Yeah. And those things have been on there for, like, 3 years. I, like, was kind of scared that I went a little too close to where the pedal goes in. I was like, oh, this thing might break. But it's been fine. Yeah, it's been good for, like, 3 years, and... That thing's taken some abuse. So,
Do you mess with the the fork, like the axle crown, like, do you make sure that's a little bit higher to bump your bottom bracket up, or is it just straight, like, whatever 130 fork?
Yeah, it's just like a, it's like, I think it's a 140 fork and it's a 29.
Okay.
It's like made for a 29. I tried to run a 140/27.5 fork and it just didn't work as well. Yeah, like the offset of the 29er and just like the axle to crown on the 29er kind of works better. If not, it got like a bit too steep. The balance of the bike fell kind of off. So, yeah. And I actually went, I was on a medium and I'm pretty sure I ordered a medium again, but a large showed up. And I was like, all right, well, maybe I'll try the large. Because like at some time, like at a few races, I was like, the medium feels like a little bit crammed. And so I went to the Slalom event last year. Colin Rachel was up at Big Bear on that large and like qualified first. I was like, oh, sick. Okay, well, this thing works. And then kind of I had like a big mistake in one of my rounds and just like wasn't able to move past, I think, like the round of eight. But anyways, I had like the slightly bigger bike worked really well. So we'll see. I don't know if it'll work at all the races. Like, I feel like you go to a slalom race, you almost need like two or three bikes with you, just depending just on the track.
How the track is. Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact that you're racing for like 30 to 45 seconds, like the smallest little like margin of improvement can help so much. So I don't know if I'll be flying with two frame sizes, but
what do you usually change on your bike? Like if you do show up somewhere, what would be a factor of the track that would cause you to like change something?
Last year at Sea Otter, there was like some pretty deep rhythm sections. And so I think I added a little bit more air pressure in the suspension just to kind of help like not have the bike cycle through the suspension as much. But besides that, really just tire pressure and tires is like the only thing that changes.
Yeah.
I would say I usually run like a booster rear, which is, I think, actually a... It kind of replaced the small block eight in a way, but it's Kenda's, it's kind of more like an XC tire. They make a 27.5 one. So like that thing I usually put in the rear and then a pinner up front. And we got like a custom kind of snip that we do on the pinner as well, just to kind of like open up some of those transition knobs a bit more. Huh. That's like a Bubba Warren special. I think he was the one who kind of did it, but it's sweet. It kind of helps like transition from like your center knobs to your side knobs. So yeah, really just tires is like the main thing. Suspension a little bit, but really like my rear shock, I run like 300 PSI in it.
I was wondering.
Just like max out the pressure. Yeah. And sometimes I'll even like, cause it's usually like an XC shock that's in the back. So sometimes I'll just even run it in like trail mode instead of like fully open mode. If it needs like, if I'm already maxed on pressure and I just need a little more support, I'll do that.
Huh. Interesting.
Would you ever want a hardtail or do you need just that little bit of suppleness in there?
I feel like just a little bit of suppleness is usually nice. Like usually slalom tracks are not super polished and smooth with the exemption being maybe like Rotorua a few years ago was like almost, you maybe drop like 30, 40 feet the whole track. It's just like almost like a flat track. And that year, I think I had a hardtail and the hardtail worked really well. But even now, like trying to get like a derailleur and shifter on a hardtail is like getting harder and harder. Like I don't think the Canyon even supports a shifter or a derailleur. I think you'd have to like, I think Dante Silva got one on, but you kind of have to like ghetto mod it to make it work. So I'm usually just kind of committed to like dual suspension, which seems to kind of work. Anyways,
since let's just keep going with this topic, but okay. You're saying it's an XC tire that you're using out back basically.
Yeah. It's like,
how do you deal with like sidewall and like tire pressure, because I imagine it's not a very robust sidewall.
Yeah, it's like their lightest or one of their lighter sidewalls. It's like the SCT casing, which is like on my trail bike in the rear on the usually the AGC, which is like the full gravity casing, and then they have a trail casing, and then they have they have an enduro casing and then a trail casing and then the XC casing. So it's like really light casing tire.
It's down
really
there.
Yeah, which is cool because like rotational weight is really low. So like getting out of the gate on like a really light tire is nice. But I pretty much just try and run like the lowest pressure I can without just blowing the tire off, which is usually I think like 35 to 38 PSI somewhere in there in the rear. I think sometimes I even go a little lower. It really just depends on the track. Like some tracks have corners that are just like so steep and you're pushing so hard into. And then others, like you can get away with a little bit less pressure. So the front, I honestly run almost the same as like a trail bike. I try and run like just under 30, like 27, 28. Because you're never really like folding the front that much. It's usually just the rear.
Yeah.
And then I'm running tubes as well.
Huh.
And I'm running, like,
does that give you a little more support Or is it just the pretty, like if you're not going
to
burp?
Yeah, I think mostly like you don't have to worry about burping. It does probably give it like a little more support as well. But yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
You're already 20 minutes in and like, oh, this is sick.
I'm taking notes for my future slalom group.
But right. Then like Eddie Masters will show up in like a 170 29er and just smoke all of us. Maybe it doesn't even matter. Those like pivot boys are so fast and they just ride their trail bikes. And like they're usually on the podium like at Crankworx events. Yeah. So like, yeah. Sometimes it like it's wild. I think slalom is one of those events where like you can win on like 3 to 4 different categories of bikes, you know? Mm-hmm. Like I'm on like a light trail bike. There's dudes on like proper trail bikes that have won. There's dudes on like full enduro bikes. Like Danny Beecroft wins on a downhill bike, you know?
Oh yeah.
Uh-huh. That's right. Yeah. Know?
And then like there's dudes on hardtails that win. Like, so it's like, it's kind of a wild discipline where it's like a lot of times you can kind of make whatever you have work.
Hmm. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I feel like we'll end up back on the topic of Crankworx at some point. Should we jump into stuff?
Yeah, let's do it.
My notes just start from the very beginning of where is Luca from? How did he get into mountain biking? And yeah, I mean, you and I kind of go way back, but when I met you, you were already established as a racing amateur mountain biker. But yeah, how'd you get into all of this?
Yeah. Yes, I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and moved pretty quickly to San Diego, where I kind of grew up. And then I grew up kind of similar, I guess, most people mountain biking, like with a BMX background. Mm-hmm. Hot topic right now. but yeah, I grew up racing at like Kearney Moto Park and Cactus for all the San Diego locals. I think I started that around, I don't know, 6 or 7. I remember just like, I think 3 or 4 years in a row, I had birthday parties at the BMX track.
Yes.
And then kind of got into racing BMX, did a little bit of traveling with it and got up to like the expert category. And then just kind of got like burnt out on just like the repetition of it, like the same tracks all the time. And like tracks don't really change much in BMX. And then I saw actually Sami Gowdy and Dakota Golder. Sami Gowdy is like now, he's still in kind of in the mountain bike community. He's like an ambassador for Vetus. Mm-hmm. And then my buddy Dakota, he lives up in Canada now. But yeah, I saw them like riding these mountain bikes and kind of doing like some wheelies right behind my elementary school. And I was like, oh, that's sweet. And then my dad was kind of always into mountain biking as well, more like cross country. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so like as I was starting to get kind of burnt out on BMX, my mom had this 26-inch giant iguana. Like female hardtail, female specific women's hardtail.
Like a drop tube, like a girl's bike, as they would call it back then.
Yeah, it had kind of like that lower standover, but it wasn't, it honestly didn't really look like a women's bike. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was before like Liv was a thing. So it was just like
a giant iguana.
Giant iguana.
That's a great name.
I know, right? It was just like a pretty low end hardtail. And so I like started riding that thing a bit. Ted's was like my local spot. Like a lot of us from like San Diego, kind of that was like the spot we would go. I remember just like getting dropped off back in the day. We called it Meadowbrook because that's like the school at the bottom there. We would just get like dropped off and we would just spend like all day there, just like pushing up laps. I remember riding some like pretty hectic trails on that thing and hitting some like pretty hectic jumps.
That's amazing.
Had like mechanical disc brakes and stuff. Like, and yeah, so I eventually like outgrew that thing pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And I convinced my dad to give me a Trek Session 77. It was actually a prototype one that I bought online. So like it had like these two extra supports right on the head tube. I don't know if they had like issues with those head tubes snapping off or what.
Interesting.
Like little gussets up there or something?
Yeah, like little gussets, exactly. And so he bought me that thing. And I remember just like right away, the first day I got it, I went and ticked off like 2 or 3 more jumps that I'd like never hit.
That's right.
And then, so that thing kind of was like the first proper mountain bike I had. And I think that was the first bike I actually raced at Fontana, which was in 2007. There was like a bunch of us where like our first race was the 2007 Southridge Classic, I think in like November.
That's actually, well, so when you see Sami and Dakota like riding, did you go meet them right away? Because you guys always had like a crew in Poway that were like, you guys are also around the same age.
Yeah.
And you guys were all really fast and good at riding. Like, how did that kind of all come about? And like, Lucas and everybody else, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was just all, we all kind of lived in like the same neighborhood, which is like Scripps Ranch. I think Sami at the time lived in Scripps Ranch. So we all lived within like a mile or two of each other. And we all kind of just like ended up at Ted's because that was kind of like the local riding spot. And mm-hmm. that's kind of where we learned to like dig and ride. Yeah. Just kind of like start to ride trails and stuff. And mm-hmm. we were all like stoked on hitting jumps. So we would even just like go and like session jumps. And so I think it was just like, we were kind of all the same age, kind of had the same interest. And that's kind of, that was kind of like the melting pot for everybody at the time.
Sweet. What about, like your family being Italian and stuff? Like, I know you, wasn't that sort of part of you getting the bikes was going over there and riding like Pila and stuff like that? Or did that come later on?
Yeah, I think that, that would have come like as I got, I think that Trek session would have been like the first bike I brought to Italy with me. I remember like flying to Italy with that thing and like my brake lines I think had like a kink in them and we like ghetto repaired them with like some hose from like the hardware store and then I would like I would like ride Pila and I would just be like riding all day and just like so excited, and then the next day it felt like both my wrists were broken. Like I remember straight up having like both my wrists just like taped up the next day and like putting them in ice because like they both felt like they were broken from just hitting like I don't know, it, like if people have ridden Pila before they know that like it's really rough there and there's some like really long descents. Mm-hmm. Like, you can do like 5-6,000 foot descents there and all like with either chairlift or like gondola access. Mm-hmm. And so like, yeah, with having like nearly no base of like riding long trails, I would just go and like murder my body and just be like, felt like I had two broken wrists the next day. So yeah, I definitely like, I would pretty much, I think from 10 or 11, I would just fly to Europe with my bike always. Because there's like some awesome riding in that area. So yeah, Pila was like the spot I would go in Europe. And then like recently Cervinia bike park, I did a, I actually did a video there kind of recently with Wiley. So that was at like a Cervinia, and that's like in the valley where like my parents actually have a like a second home there. Because we have all our family there, and yeah, we just would go there every summer and spend like a few months there. And so my dad ended up like buying a little condo there. And so, yeah, I still try and go back almost every year out there, but, yeah, I don't remember where this question all started, but yeah, no,
I think the question's stemming from as another Grom who grew up nearby, but I didn't meet your whole crew till I was probably like 15 or 16.
Yeah.
But you know, like at the time, I remember you guys were always putting out videos, like little homie videos. Mm-hmm. And I can like vividly remember, like, cause you had, your bike was orange. What was it? Was it a Chumba?
Yeah. So I had that Trek session and then I briefly, I think, had a Foes Fly.
Okay.
Which was pretty much broken from when I got it. And then after that, I had just like the suspension, like never worked on that thing. And then, cause it was like that, yeah, like that weird faux suspension. Uh-huh. And then I had a Turner DHR, which was like the orange bike.
That's right.
Yeah. And then that's probably when we met. I think that was when I would have been like 13 or 14 at the time when we met.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You were like in Encinitas and I was in Scripps Ranch, which like when you can't drive, that's a long distance away.
No.
You know, it's 30 minutes away, which isn't that bad. But
yeah
we were. I guess we had never met because you were just like far enough away and you kind of had your own little like riding scene where you were. So I think we ended up probably meeting at like Fontana or.
I think so. I mean, like I remember on Pink Bike watching all of your guys' videos because like Lucas had like a green bike or something.
He had the green Chumba.
And like somebody maybe had like a yellow bike, and it sounds dumb, but like I didn't know anything about mountain biking, but I was like, that's the kid on the orange bike. That's the kid on the green bike. And at the time, like, for me, I got into mountain biking a little bit later, so I was like kind of like watching all the videos and all the stuff. And then it was like, whoa, this is a group of kids in San Diego that look like the people on the videos because they're all super good. Mm-hmm. But I knew nothing about it. I had no idea where Ted's was. And like, you know, Ted's is an insane spot because it's not huge. It's in between a bunch of neighborhoods, but there's a bunch of riders that have come out and made like a career out of downhill or mountain biking from it. And I just always was so fascinated. Like, I remember, like, videos, especially because you were a little bit younger than them, like a year or two. Mm-hmm. Like, just the most like ridiculous jumps and like just like little kids sprinting into massive jumps. I remember you did like a huge suicide over, we'll have to find this video. Okay. It's like massive suicide. And I was like, that's the craziest thing I've ever seen. Like I will never do that. but yeah, I think our paths did cross sometime later on, probably at Fontana. Cause I met Dakota, and a few other kids first, but it was pretty quick. Like it was right when I kind of started racing. I probably got like my license around then. And then pretty quickly I started hanging out with you guys. But how do you think you progressed so quickly? Like, I mean, I think Ted's probably a huge part of that, but like, did you do camps or anything? And then like, how quickly did you start, like you end BMX racing, you get into mountain biking, and then like, how quickly did you go to Fontana? Like what was that kind of timeline
like? Yeah, so I think I ended BMX racing probably around 11. I think I still did some BMX racing when I started mountain biking, but it was kind of like, I was like, oh, this mountain biking thing's a lot more fun than BMX. And so, yeah, I think my first race would have been 11 when I was 11. And then I think I pretty quickly just fully quit BMX after that. And yeah, so like BMX quit around 11, started racing mountain bikes pretty consistently around 11. I think I would do like the whole winter series events. I probably did those consistently for like 4 or 5 years, maybe even longer. And then coaching wise, most of it was just like us riding and like feeding off each other. I mean, all of us just like riding and being like these competitive little kids and just like wanting to do better. And I was always the youngest kid. So I feel like Sami was like the ringleader. He was like the best. Like Sami's still the sickest rider, but like some of the stuff he would do back in the day, just like how he would ride a bike and like he would just do like these wheelies between sections. Like his bike control is just like insane.
Yeah.
So I feel like we always looked up to him and he was like the fastest rider in the group. And then Lucas would maybe be like the next best, and he was like slightly younger than Sami. And then
Lucas Cowan.
Yeah. And then I was like the little super grom that was just like trying to keep up. But I feel like it's kind of like, I feel like a lot, I mean, you look at like Jet Lawrence and Hunter, or even like Luca Shaw and Walker Shaw, like the younger always seems to like, you know, either they start earlier or they just like want to be better than the older brother. So like to me, those were almost like the older brothers that I wanted to be better than. And so I think that was like my main drive, was just like, oh, I want to be better than like the older kids.
Totally. I mean, it makes sense, right? It's motivating. Yeah.
And then for coaching, I did quite a few of those better ride clinics with Gene Hamilton.
Yeah, Mean Gene. Yeah.
Yeah. And that dude is like still one of the best coaches I've ever had. Just like, I remember going out to Bootleg Canyon and we spent like, I think it was like a whole entire day just on like cornering drills. Like in a parking lot. Like, I don't even think we went up the hill. It was just like learning how to corner properly. And there was just like, when he really breaks it down, I'm like, holy crap, I didn't realize there was so much to cornering. You know, but like he was just so good at breaking down each thing and just being like, no, you need to do this better. No, you need to do this better. You know, like, yeah, like at the end of those days, you're just like so fried because it's just like so much information you're taking in. But I think I probably did like 2 or 3 of those camps.
And he was pretty early on with all that stuff. Like one of the first kind of real skills coaches, it seems like.
I think so. Yeah. At least around this area that I knew of. So yeah, I think he's still doing clinics. I always told people, like, people are like, oh, carbon wheels. I'm like, literally take that money and invest it into coaching and you'll see way more gains than you'll ever see from a set of like carbon wheels, you know, like upgrading your wheel set. I always tell people, like, coaching over carbon. That's like my like
that's a good bumper sticker.
But really, like, yeah, like coaching, like you may think you may be like a good rider, and I remember even Gene would like, he would talk trash on like he like loved Greg Menard because like Greg is just like on a fundamental level like such a good rider. And I remember he would always talk so much trash on G Atherton, because G's like, obviously G crushes it and he has had like insane results, but he's kind of like always been like, you know, off the back, elbows kind of down, just like never really had like the proper form, I guess. Obviously, I mean, say what you want, like that dude won races and like won titles and everything. Like,
yeah, it's two ways to an end sort of a thing.
But yeah, so I remember he would always like, yeah, like, oh, look at what Greg's doing. And Greg, I think, actually came and did some coaching with him as well.
Yeah, I kind of remember seeing that at some point.
But so yeah, that dude's worked with like tons of people. And I think like when Greg would come, he would always, it would be like maybe between races, and he would come do like one of those skills camps, and then he would do like better at the next race. Because like sometimes like when you're when you're chasing to be like better, it can be hard to go back to like those fundamentals and be like, oh yeah, I forgot to point my elbow in that corner, mm-hmm. or like I forget to get low, you know, like you kind of need, sometimes you almost need to go back to those like basics to like improve as a rider.
Mm-hmm.
Even like, I think the top like riders need to go do that. I mean, like for somebody sure. like Greg,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
the greatest of all time. He needs to go back and just like even do like some drills in a parking lot probably mm-hmm. once in a while.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the same as you pointing out coaching over carbon, like anybody no matter the level they're at can always revisit basics because you mm-hmm. start thinking of something else or thinking about your bike or setup. And
yeah.
Yeah. It's always valuable.
Yeah. And then like now I've started doing some coaching with Highland as mm-hmm. well. And I feel like, yeah, when I'm like
Highland Bike Park.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I'll do like some of the adult airs and then the kids air academy too.
Cool.
And yeah, that also makes me like, oh yeah, how do you actually ride a bike? You know, like having to think about like breaking things down for people. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it always helps me too.
Because
mm-hmm. then I'm like extra focused on it. And I'm yeah. not trying to, you know, I'm not out there trying to go like as fast as I can. I'm out there like trying to help people get better at riding.
Yeah.
So like it makes me think about, okay, yeah, what have I not been doing?
Mm-hmm.
Like the other day I was like, man, I think it's because I've been riding a bunch with like a camera bag on. Mm-hmm. There's just so much weight in the back. It's hard to get like over the front end.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, man, I just feel like I've just like been riding in defense mode. So I'm like, all right, I need to get back like over the front of the mm-hmm. bike and like, yeah, remind the front wheel that traction exists. So yeah, I guess that would be like the transition from like BMX and a mountain bike and kind of like coaching. Yeah, it was, I would say I would give it all up to like Gene. That dude's awesome.
Mm, sweet.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Betterride.net if you're interested.
Yeah.
Hit up me and Gene. He's always in the forums. Like he comments. I hope he, mm-hmm. I'll make sure he tries to listen to this one. Yeah. He's good.
Sweet. I mean, so you start racing, like what, obviously you've stuck with that and have made a career out of it over the years, but what maybe drew you to it? And then like, you know, we always talk about Fontana, like Fontana mm-hmm. for anyone who's grown up in Southern California is like this odd little hill in the middle of the Inland Empire that yeah. so many of us have come out of, like, maybe talk about Fontana too and like those first early years of racing.
Yeah, Fontana, it's kind of a bummer to see it now because it's not what it used to be, I feel like. I mean, it's still the same hill and it's still like Donnie putting it on.
Mm-hmm.
But like when we were there, like there would be races, there'd be like 20 or 30 juniors, you know, mm-hmm. like it was like competitive racing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was awesome because like we were racing at the time where like most people are skiing because they can't ride their bikes, you know? Like, yep. So like we're spending time on the racetrack, like sprinting our freaking butts off on the wall, trying to get in shape for the races while like the rest of the country's like stuck in snow.
Yep.
So like, yeah, I like owe so much with my racing to like Donnie and all those dudes at Fontana, like putting on those local races, and just trying to like, yeah, push ourselves throughout that off season. So like when some of those bigger events came around, we were like already had like mm-hmm. 4 or 5 races under our belts.
Yeah.
So yeah, like Fontana was kind of the start for me. And then I think the first race I went to that wasn't Fontana might have been this San Ynez. It was like a race in San Ynez Classic or something.
Hmm. Okay.
Like kind of central-ish California near Santa Barbara. I remember it being like 110 degrees all weekend and just like barely, I think I did 2 practice runs because it was so hot. But yeah, so like apart from Fontana, just kind of started to do some of the, I guess they wouldn't have been pro GRTs at the time. They would have been. Wasn't Norba's. Maybe they were pro GRTs.
I mean, what year would that have been? Oh, it might have been before I was racing.
Might have been like 2009 or 2010.
Hmm. I mean, I could always pull up the old Roots and Rain.
Yeah, I know. I was actually looking at some Roots and Rain stuff this morning. But yeah, so Fontana, I think, kind of transitioned more to some of like the Nationals. And then from there, I guess it would have gone to World Cups. Yeah, that's the thing, is like there's not really like a super clean transition from, you go kind of like local racing, national racing, and then World Cups. That's kind of like
you did yeah, 2 Norbas. See. You were a Norba racer.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I remember like
in 2008 right... you did a Fontana and then you did that Santa Ynez Valley.
Okay, so that was the race.
Weird.
Santa Ynez. I didn't know it was a
considered
Norba,
like
actually.
A Norba national.
Apparently,
some
yeah.
kind of Norba
yeah,
sanction
it's
thing.
2008 okay. Norba number one is all it says.
Okay.
Weird.
10th out of 13, then I got a 5th out of 6th.
Nice. Holding it down.
Which actually was one of my questions I'm going to have is like, when you started racing, did you have immediate success? Because like, I started racing in 2010 and started in 2011. And like, especially at Fontana, you just want everything. Like, there is a few other friends that like kind of dice it up, but like, I remember you were always winning stuff.
Well, yeah. So when I started racing, I was in like the 11 to 12 category.
Mm-hmm.
With it was like me and Dylan Unger. I think we're like maybe the only two people in it. And then everybody, like, I think you were maybe a year or two older than me, right? So you would you raced like the 13 to 15 category.
Well, when I started racing, I went straight to sport 18 under because been 15 or 16.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe I'm thinking of like early days. Like I remember there was the beginner 11 to 12 and then beginner 13 to 15.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like just young enough that I was like the 11 to 12 and the 13 to 15 was like way more stacked.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there was like way more people in the 13 to 15 category. So I think I had like success early on because it was like me and another dude.
Yeah. I would say there is a lot of first out of two, but
yeah, exactly. It'd be like me and Dylan Unger. I think we're like always the two. And then, yeah, then we had the whole like sport 18 and under category,
yep.
Which I think that's where we probably first raced together. And mm-hmm. then it went to like expert 18 and under. Yeah. So yeah, I don't honestly remember any of those. Like, I don't know if they're listed on there, but I don't remember like some of those early results.
On Roots and Rain, you have 168 results, which is pretty high.
Well, that's a lot. The thing is, like, that's not even all the races I've done.
For sure.
There's definitely races on there that, like, are not contributed for.
Just cap it at 200, maybe.
We might be closer to 200.
Yeah, I mean, you know, those first few years, there's a ton of Fontana Winter Series, a few Sea Otters in there.
Oh, yeah. That one might have actually been the first bigger race I went to was like Sea Otter. I
mean, yeah.
There was like the San Ynez race, but then Sea Otter. Remember, Sea Otter always fell on my brother's birthday, so I could never get my parents to take me to Sea Otter. But then I think eventually, like as the years went on, it was like far enough from my brother's birthday that we, like, was able to make it. And so I think Sea Otter was one of the events where I was like wanted to go for so what felt like for so long, which is probably 2 years.
Yeah.
And then the third year I was like finally able to go because it like didn't fall exactly on my brother's birthday.
For sure. Dude, it's crazy. In 2010, you were Cat 2, 15 to 18 at Sea Otter, and you got ninth out of 106 riders.
Holy cow.
That's incredible.
Many. Cat 2. Wow.
That is so many people.
Yeah.
It's actually is very convenient to scroll through someone's history of racing mountain bikes. But I mean, you have a Pila race, a IXS Cup in 2010.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
Which,
I remember doing that.
Which, I guess that makes sense. It says 17 to 18. I'm like, I don't think you were 17 to 18 then, but not 2010, but.
Yeah, no, 2010, I would have been probably 15.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm. Race age might have been 17, or maybe that was just like the only category that was like close enough.
Because your birthday is December, right?
December 8th, 1995.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, I'm December 9th.
What?
But about 50 years later.
I kind of remember that because how race age works, like you were basically racing, it's your age at the end of the year, so you were racing up more or less the entire year. And where I'm the other way around. My birthday's in January, so I was always the age at which I was racing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember like, I think it might've been Richie Rude. I think his birthday is like December 31st or January 1st.
I think it's his like a January 1 or 2.
Because mm-hmm. he was always like the kid who seemed like he was a junior forever.
Yeah.
Because he was
forever
the best
junior.
Birthday. Yeah.
I'm like, we still have to race him? God.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, we could talk probably for hours about all of that, but like, how'd we go from Fontana to racing World Cups, like kind of what was that? I mean, I'm assuming racing World Cups was probably always a goal, like from an early on age. And we'll get into like you being on Intense Factory Racing and all that, but like what were those first few years? I don't remember if it was like immediately you just went to that or
no. There was a few years where like racing as a junior, I think the first year I raced as a junior, I was on like some sort of like nuke proof NEMA.
That's right.
Sort of. Mm-hmm. Deal.
Oh, NEMA. Yeah.
NEMA. Uh-huh. Yeah.
TBT.
Uh-huh. And then the second year, I think maybe that's when I was on an Intense bike, but I don't think I was technically like, I was definitely not on the factory team. The factory team didn't come until I went pro. I think I also did like 1 year on Intense doing a few World Cups where I wasn't pro or sorry, where I wasn't on the factory team. And then I remember like, yeah, I was like pretty tight with Intense, like being so close in Temecula. And I think I sent them like a proposal of all the races I wanted to do. And they're like, why don't you come in and we can like have a meeting? Mm-hmm. And like we had that meeting and they were like, yeah, we think we want to have you like on this World Cup team. And I was like, what? I was like blown away that like I was like expecting them to be like, oh yeah, we can support you with some like nationals and stuff. And then I went from like thinking that that's what the meeting was going to be about to them being like, yeah, we want you to be like on the World Cup team.
Wow.
So I think like that year 20, I think it was 2015, I believe was the first year. I did like a half season racing World Cups. And then 2016 was like my first full year doing World Cups with Intense. And I think that might have actually been my like final year. I had a 2-year contract, but they had like the right to like renew it for the second year. And I just like didn't have that great of a season. Had like mechanicals and just like, yeah, a little bit of mechanic sabotage. Unfortunately.
Really?
Like yeah. The actual mechanic?
Yeah, I mean, he's like
or
a
like
solid
negligence dude. Or just
he's like so we yeah, the main thing was we were sponsored by this company called Juice Lubes, which does like
yeah, they're kind of back in the game here again, I think a little bit.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, which like yeah, they make a bunch of rad like bike cleaner and like chain lubes and stuff, but like the cleaner we were using had like silicone in the cleaner. And so you had to be like really careful where you sprayed it. And there was like a few instances where my brakes got contaminated with it. Mm. And I remember being like at the top of my runs, like, you know, pedaling around and being like, dude, these brakes aren't working. I mean, they're working, but they're dragging.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like, I remember it happened twice. I think it happened. I think the first time was at Mount St. Anne. I dropped into my race run at Mount St. Anne. I was like freaking out before my run, 'cause like my brakes weren't stopping on a dime. And like Mount St. Anne, you have like that start gate and then you're like carrying a bit of pace. And then mm-hmm. there's like one section where you're like heavy braking into like a left-hander. Mm-hmm. That's maybe like 20 seconds in. Before that, you're like hardly touching the brakes. And I remember coming into that section, brakes just like did not stop. And I just went over the tape. And then, and it was because like, yeah, my brakes weren't working because we used that like bike wash that had like the silicone in it. Mm-hmm. And so like super pissed, got back up and I was like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. And then I think my bottom splits were like top 20 splits. Like if oh, you look really? At just like the split times at the bottom, mm-hmm. I think that was like some of the best splits I ever had. 'Cause I was just like riding with so much anger just from falling off the track.
Rage riding.
Rage riding for sure. Just like not caring like what was going to happen. So uh-huh. I was like, well, I already blew my race run. So I'm just going to take it out on this track right now.
Sucks.
And then it happened again in Andorra. I think I like mentioned, I was like, hey dude, like don't wash my bike. Just like wipe it down.
Dude, in Andorra and, back then, like you needed the brakes, right? Yeah. Like it's so steep.
Well, luckily like Andorra starts kind of flat and then it gets steep. So like there, it wasn't as big a deal. It was like the brakes weren't super dialed, but by the time you needed like your heavy braking, the brakes were like had burned off whatever was on them.
Okay.
And so I ended up being fine there. But I remember like, yeah, he's like a Spanish dude. So I think there might've been like a slight like lack of whatever, like a little bit of like miscommunication. And I was like, hey, just like don't wash my bike. And I think I went to go do something, came back and like my bike had been washed. And then it was like shortly after that we had like my race run, and I think it was again like the brakes just weren't working that great. And so yeah, that was like the race, that was actually the last race I would have done with Intense Factory Racing. After that was like the last race of the year. And after finals day, we were like sat at the bottom of the track, and Jen from Intense, I remember her like, yeah, sorry, we're like, we're not going to re-sign you for next year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And I just remember like, cool. I just like, I think I might have not qualified. I don't know. You can probably check that. Whatever. I remember like not being that great of a weekend, and then like got that news and just being just like so bummed. Like you kind of like with racing, I've always had a hard time with just like the highs and lows of it, just like probably most people do. Mm-hmm. So like you're coming down off this like extreme kind of like high where like you didn't reach your goal. Mm-hmm. And then you get news on top of that, that like you lost your ride. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being just like so bummed. And then it was like, it was so late at that point that I was like, man, you could have told me this like two races ago. Then I would have been able to start having conversations with people like in person.
Yeah.
I remember being bummed that it was like waited so long to tell me. I would like have preferred to have that news. Maybe to like light a little bit of a fire under my ass too. Like, hey, you lost your ride. So like you better perform these last few rounds if you want to like get another ride.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like lost my ride. And then the next year I was like trying to figure out a ride, but like had kind of not the greatest season. And so didn't end up getting a ride. Ended up, I think, just getting some sort of like support through Commonsol USA and trying to go to some races. But like, I'm sure like many Americans know, like the World Cup is pretty much like a European Cup. So like you're flying to Europe And if you're like self-supported, it's like you got to handle your logistics. You got to handle, like, I didn't have a mechanic with me the following year. So like I did all my wrenching, all my travel planning. And then on top of that, like your training, you have to get like registered for the event. There's like, you're like wearing
full privateer mode basically. Yeah.
Yeah. You're just wearing like so many hats. And it's just like, on top of that, you're trying to like qualify at these events that are like so gnarly.
Yeah. And everybody's been to them a bunch of times. And yeah, like, yeah, there's a lot of fact. Is that the summer that you went over to Europe for like a couple months and tried to hit a bunch of stuff?
Yeah, I think that would have been that summer. I think that would have been 2017.
Yeah, because like on here, it looks like 2016 was the only year that you were truly on intense factory racing. Because maybe just to cover, like 2015, I think, is when you were like supported by him, but not like on the factory program. Maybe they didn't have it just yet. Because like the end of that year on here was super good for you. It was like you had Mont Saint-Anne, Wyndham, and then Val d'Isol.
That was 2015 or 2016?
This is 2015.
Yeah, so 2015, that was the year we were, I remember we were on like the aluminum M16s.
Yeah. And that was factory team
though. That was like the factory team, but I just didn't do a whole season. I did like a half season.
Yeah.
Because it was kind of like my introduction to the team. And so I don't think I was technically even on like a salary that year. It was kind of just like a bit of a trial just to see how things went. And I think I actually had a few like decent results that year. Decent as in like I qualified.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you had a 35th at Mont Saint-Anne, 63rd at Wyndham, and then 36th at Val d'Isol, and then Andorra was Worlds and you got 26th.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I think that's like your best result at World Cups, right?
Yeah. I think 26th would have been like my best. Technically it was like World Champs, so there's like a few less people, but like that would have been like,
it's only the best people though. You know, there's a few less, but like, yeah, they're just all the best.
You're just lacking like the five Brits that are usually in the top 20 because like that team's so stacked. But yeah, so that would have been like my best result would have been like that 26th.
Yeah.
And then the following year, we got on the carbon bikes. And I just remember like not chilling with the carbon bike as much as the aluminum bike. The aluminum bike
was
just
the
like...
the M29? Like that was the first carbon one they did?
No, this would have still been the M16. This would have been the carbon M16. The M29 came... 27.5.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The M29 came late, like once I was off of them already.
I think that was the following year, because I feel like that's when Jack got third at Fort William on the aluminum 29er mule.
Yeah, I forgot.
I think that would have been the following year.
Yeah, because that year, like Jack was still on, Dean was still on, Nick, and then Charlie would essentially have kind of like taken my spot on the team as like the fourth rider. So yeah, like going from that aluminum M16 to the carbon one, just like never liked it as much. Felt like all the feedback, like from the stiffness of the carbon, just like everything went into like the handlebars. And I just remember like not gelling with that bike quite as good as, and we didn't really change any like component sponsors. It was like just the bike that was different. I think I even remember asking like, can I go back in the aluminum one? Yeah. Cause like, I just preferred the aluminum one. And I mean, it is, yeah, it is what it is. Like it was still an awesome bike. It just was like, I feel like the aluminum one I'd like definitely enjoyed more. So yeah, after getting off of Intense, it was kind of on this like privateer commons hall thing. And then I think that's when I technically did my first Crankworx event would have been, I think it was Leger.
And was the focus then just downhill still? Like
it was, yeah, mostly downhill, but I like always loved riding, like I always kind of raced slalom. I loved like riding pump tracks. I think that, 2017 I did a Crankworx round and then that's where I was kind of like, whoa, you can fly to Europe and you don't have to worry about qualifying at one race. You can go and do like four different events and get like way more kind of like bang for your buck for events. And then there was like the TV side of things. Like they had Red Bull TV, or maybe it wasn't even Red Bull TV at the time, but whatever, they had like live coverage and it was well, this seems way more valuable than like not qualifying in a World Cup, you know? Or even qualifying in a World Cup and like not, you don't make the live feed unless you're top 20 or whatever, or top 30. So like, yeah, I just remember going to a Crankworx event and then I was kind of like sold on trying to pursue like Crankworx stuff. And I've always, loved like riding the small bikes.
Yeah.
So I was like able to go and like bring a few bikes and like do a bunch of different events. And I remember that being like way more fun. And so I think shortly after that, I kind of gave up on like the World Cup dream of like trying to be a privateer from America and trying to go qualify at these World Cups. And that's kind of when Crankworx started to like come into my life, I guess. Or, like kind of started to follow that a little more serious.
Yeah. Did it feel like a natural progression from World Cups to that? Like you say you gave up the dream of World Cup racing, but did you feel like you had chased it down enough that you were like stoked with this, but Crankworx seems to be fitting more my vibe now.
Like, yeah. I think I always like wanted to still be like a World Cup racer, but I just like didn't have like the energy or really the funds to make it happen. And Crankworx, I think I saw some like pretty quick kind of success with it in terms of like on the smaller bikes, like doing well. And then also just like World Cup racing is so scary, like going and like throwing your body down. Like there would be times where you go practice in the dry and then your first run in the wet is like your race run. And you just know you have to like send your life.
Yeah.
And so I just remember being like, I just remember like sleeping some nights and like you hear the rain start coming down and just being like, you just have this pit in your stomach knowing you have to go like ride the next day in the wet.
No way.
And then if you're like a privateer too, it's like you got to do practice and then usually want to like put fresh tires on for your race run and then you have to clean your bike and it's just like so much work.
Yeah,
like,
it's exhausting.
Trying to do it all. And then like you go, yeah, I went to Crankworx and I would like race on the small bikes and it's just like, you know, like a hardtail or slalom bike requires like nearly no work done to it. You know, if you're not like switching tires every day, like I think I still have the same set of tires on my hardtail I've had like for the last year and a half, you know? So I think there was also an appeal there where it's like, yeah, you're bringing more bikes, which like can kind of be more work, but then most of those bikes require like hardly any work. And then those events too, I like saw myself doing better at like the small bike stuff.
Yeah.
And like getting on like the live feed and like, yeah, I think for like, for sponsors, that's actually where I started to see like people started to see, I guess, like more value in me in a way. And I kind of started piecing together my own program with all these different sponsors and kind of like, I guess, being like my own agent in a way and just kind of like dealing with all my own sponsors. And that's kind of like a way too that I found to like bring more money in and being able to like get to more events is like you handle all that yourself. Cause like on Intense, it was like we had, you know, you come on and everything's handled, which is awesome. But like I was, yeah, like my salary was like, I think it was, I'll just say it, I don't really care. My salary the first year was I think like $11,000, which like getting paid to race your bike is awesome, but like nobody's living on $11,000 a year, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And so like even, yeah, like now I'm able to like pick and choose sponsors that I like want to work with, and then I have like a closer relationship with them as well. And then you can, there's like a lot more money to be had if you can manage the sponsors properly as well.
That's actually something later on I want to get into, was kind of how you approach marketing yourself, which I think you sort of just explained it. But I've always admired the ability that you have to leverage what you can provide brands. And I think you're really good at seeing what you can offer brands and then, you know, like putting that on display for them and like creating a value. I think a lot of riders, racers, whatever, assume they have an ability and they can just rely on that ability to have whatever it is, product support, money, come their way. But like, I mean, you guys explained it pretty well. My question was kind of like, what's your mindset like when you approach a brand? I mean, is it, we'll probably dive into like all your photo video stuff, but it seems like now you're really able to leverage like, hey, I can provide XYZ content for you guys. I'm also an athlete at Crankworx events. Like what's, I don't know, maybe dive into more of that, I guess. Like,
yeah.
And because it seems like that was transitional for you, I guess, as you find Crankworx and kind of a variety of events and styles
because too, like you're saying with like World Cup racing and all that, I did all of that and was like, this is so exhausting, I'm not doing this anymore. You know what I mean? Like I shared a lot of the same views and I just started working for companies and kind of went that route and it worked out fine. And I've always seen you being like, I'm like, damn, he's like really hustling and like making it work, you know? It's not easy. It's not easy to like get a bunch of brands to come on board with like what it is you have, because the reality is like we're sort of all a dime a dozen a little bit, you know? Like there's a ton of talented riders out there.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And I always kind of felt like, I remember always looking at Jason and being like, man, that dude's like way, he's getting like better results than I am. Like he should be having more opportunities. And like, but like you said, you kind of went down like a different, like you kind of started focusing more like I remember on school and then like working for brands versus like I was just like trying to make things work somehow. But I guess maybe taking like a step back, like when I was young, like growing up at Ted's, like I had my dad's Rebel XTI. That was like my first camera I ever had, And I remember just like going out to Ted's and we would just be there all day and I would just like shoot photos.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember shooting like ISO 3200 and being like, why is it so grainy? Just like not understanding camera settings. And I just, yeah. So like from an early age, we would just go and like film each other, shoot photos. I remember mm-hmm. compiling like these huge slideshows and posting them on Pink Bike.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, I had just like these terrible camera, like video cameras back in the day, but just like making edits with like these little point and shoot cameras. Mm-hmm. So like it started from a super young age. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of wild to think about now how like all of that work that I was doing as like an 11-year-old is now like what I do for a living,
uh-huh.
you know? And it's like some people, like I never went to college. So like a lot of people, like college is those years where they like essentially go through like school to like learn these skills. But like mm-hmm. I was learning these skills on my own with like my friends on my bikes, like mm-hmm. from such a young age. And so I guess it was kind of just like the natural progression of like, I knew how to use a camera. I knew how to kind of how to like produce content that like people were watching.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of like led into, I guess maybe like what people see value in me is like my ability to like produce content and to like, yeah, essentially like use myself or like use other people to help me like produce these content for brands.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess also too, it's just like having like a relationship with people and just like being a human and not, mm-hmm. you know, like some people are so heavy into like their racing and they like sometimes forget to be like human.
Yeah.
And so just like trying to be like a human being and like having conversations and like asking questions and being like fine sometimes if it's like maybe it's just not meant to work out with this brand, you know? Like,
yeah,
you know, like not every single brand is going to work for every single person.
Mm.
So I feel like I've got like a good mix of brands that support me now that like see value in me for like an athlete, a filmer, photographer, kind of like product testers for some of them, like
yeah,
different brands, I guess, see like valuing me for different things. But yeah, even today, like I had a meeting with, going back to Scott Hart this morning, and I was like texting, we had like this group chat going about like this film shoot we're trying to get going. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been on like 5 different shoots this week for like 4 different companies. So I've had like a pretty hectic week.
Yeah.
I shot for like Giant last Thursday, Friday I had off, Saturday, Sunday shot for TRP, Monday shot for Canyon, and then yesterday shot for Crank Brothers. So just had like a heavy day. And then I was like texting this morning about this shoot with we're supposed to do in March.
Uh-huh.
And then on top of that, we had like a meeting set up for this like separate Canyon shoot with like Ken Roxon.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott's like, dude, you got to chill out like on this producing stuff. Like, you remember, like you're a bike rider. Yeah.
Dude, that's what he said this morning. Yeah. He texts, he's like, go easy on him. He's got to get some saddle time.
Yeah. He's like, when's the last time you rode your bike? I was like, no, it's only been like 2 days. Like I went,
uh-huh.
like we shot all day Sunday and I think we had to meet at like 10:30. So I just woke up at 7 and went for like 2-hour ride before mm-hmm. shooting all day. So just, I don't know. I'm just like trying to not like make any excuses to like get my training in. But sometimes when you're shooting all day, it can be hard to like go out and get those rides done.
Shoot, yeah, especially if you're kind of on bike or out on the trail all day for a shoot, especially if it's mountain bike related, yeah. And then you're like, all right, let me go put on my gear again and go for a pedal or yeah. whatever it is. E-bikes. Mm-hmm. So that's when e-bikes come into play.
Yeah, well, the e-bike has kind of become more a tool for me for like shooting on the trail as mm-hmm. it has been for like going out and actually riding. Like mm-hmm. my e-bike's pretty much like my camera. It's like I consider it like a gimbal or a lens now. It's almost like, I started doing a lot more of these like tracking shots with using like riding one-handed and just like holding the camera.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Cool.
I yeah. feel like that's almost kind of become like my signature for like a lot of video pieces. Like
dude, that's awesome.
We went, yeah, man, so we're going on some tangents here, but I'll just,
that's all right. Do you have a gimbal with that? Or sometimes you just,
I just
handle...
hold the gimbal like in my hand. Yeah, so yeah. like I remember, yeah, we went to Spain last year and did the shoot for Fox with mm-hmm. Greg Minar. And I was able to hit up a couple buddies there and get sorted with like a couple e-bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like a bunch of sections on the trail where there was like a fire road right next to it. And I was like, oh, sweet. I'll be able to do like some of those gimbal moves. And I remember it's like setting some pretty rowdy roads with like speed bumps in them or like water bars or whatever.
Yeah.
And just like trying to like single op this like camera on the side while like tracking Greg through like the bushes. So like you can see like there's a lot of those like side tracking shots. It's in the Fox 36 video with Greg Minar. Mm-hmm. Came out maybe like a year ago now, but like all those sidetracking shots are just like me riding down a hill with my gimbal and on an e-bike.
That's awesome. I love it.
In that way, it's kind of become like a bit more of a tool for me, like the e-bike. But so yeah, going back to like like marketing with like brands and stuff. It's really just like finding what these like brands need and what they like value you for, mm-hmm. and just like trying to help them produce content and yeah, I guess kind of like fit the like marketing strategies they're after and mm-hmm. stuff. And
how much is it split when you have relationships or deals with brands that are like Luca, the producer, filmer, videographer, mm-hmm. and Luca, the like racer, like, is it shifting more towards like being a video asset for them versus a rider, or does it just depend?
It kind of depends. Like with Canyon, they're like one of my main supporters, like on the bike and like behind the camera.
Okay.
So cool. Like I have a deal with Canyon as an athlete, mm-hmm. and then I have like a certain amount of budget allocated for like producing content, mm-hmm. but that content has to get approved from Canyon. But then like I just did a dream build and then like this Roxen video. So that's like completely separate budgets.
Okay.
And so that's like budgets that are coming from different areas mm-hmm. that I'm getting paid to produce content for them, but yeah. for like these different athletes or yeah. for different things. So now for myself.
That's cool.
So it's, I feel like I kind of lay down like a pretty strict-ish line of mm-hmm. like, hey, you have like Luca the athlete and you have Luca the filmer, and mm-hmm. there's like two different rates for those things. So like, yeah. Cause it can, if not, it can get kind of like, it can be like a bit of a slippery slope of like, you start being like, oh yeah, I can do that. And then before mm-hmm. you know it, you're doing like way more than you committed for. Mm-hmm. And so I try and a lot of brands are like really respectful of it. Like it's not like brands are hounding me like, oh, why aren't you doing this? Mm-hmm. We pay you as an athlete. They're very like understanding about it, but sometimes you kind of just have to lay that stuff out ahead of time. So like brands know that like, hey, yeah, he is a filmer, but it's going to cost you more for him to be a filmer. Mm-hmm. Like you have him as an athlete. You don't yeah. have him as like a filmer unless it's kind of built into the contract already. Yeah. So
that's cool though.
Yeah.
Do brands care about how many likes you get on posts or how many followers you have?
I feel like brands do. I feel like social media is so valuable, mm-hmm. you know, because it used to be like magazines or like video parts, and now there's still video parts, but it's all done through like these social media apps, whether it's YouTube or Instagram, and then magazines have kind of gone away. So like, I feel like social media is one of those things where you can draw like direct, like, hey, okay, this many people engaged with my content this month or whatever. Mm-hmm. And brands can see that. And like, yeah, as silly as it may be, it's like your follower count kind of is a direct representation a lot of times of like your value as an athlete. Mm-hmm. I feel like, depending what kind of athlete you are. Obviously, there's athletes that are like valued more for other things. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, I mean, you look at a dude like Fabio Widmer or Danny McCaskill, and those dudes have like millions of followers. And those dudes are probably some of the highest paid athletes in the world.
Yeah.
And then you have racers like, who's that dude who won? He was like on the Madison team. He like won the overall during like COVID. Matt Walker.
Yeah.
That dude has like almost no social mm-hmm. content, but like, he's still valuable because he's like, he won a World Cup overall and he's like winning races and doing well at races. Sure. So like, I think for brands, a dude like Loic Bruni, who is like so well-spoken and multi-time world champion, like an amazing mm-hmm. racer, but can also help. He's like good at filming. Mm-hmm. He did like the whole like fast life thing, which like, I don't think that was like necessarily his idea, but like, mm-hmm. you know, that's like very valuable as well. So I think like, being able to still be like a really good, talented rider, but then also being really good at like the social media stuff is like really valuable for brands.
Yeah, for sure.
What do you think about the people who are good at social media, but not necessarily that good at riding bikes?
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, within reason, like there's some people, that's their angle. Like,
totally.
Hey, I'm just a Joe, but I'm out here having fun or riding bikes. But some people seem to blur the lines of,
yeah,
I should be getting stuff because I'm good at social media, but my skills aren't like what you guys have.
For sure. Yeah. I guess I felt like so kind of, I don't know, like what the word is, like, yeah, I guess frustrated maybe in a way, but then at the end of the day, it's like, these dudes are appealing to a different audience than maybe I'm appealing to. Mm-hmm. And like, if I'm getting into like a different sport, whether it's like moto or surfing or rock climbing, it's like, I don't necessarily need to be like, okay, I'm getting into road racing, so what does Lance Armstrong say I should do? You know, it's like maybe somebody yeah. who is like mm-hmm. a little more in my wheelhouse. He's like the dude that I can relate to more. And he's kind of like a good introduction. But then I think people like they get introduced to something, and then there needs to be like that next step forward.
Yeah.
So like, I think somebody like that, Seth Spikes Hacks, you know, like he's not a very good rider. He is a decent rider, but he's not like that dude's not going out and winning races.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that dude's probably.
He sends it.
Oh, he definitely. Tries, you know? Oh, he definitely is out there like sending it. And that dude, like I listen to a podcast with him, and I mean, that dude is like, he's great at producing content. He's great at talking to the camera. He's great at like engaging with his audience. And so like, who am I to take away? Who am I to take something like that away from somebody who's like, they may not be the best rider, but that doesn't mean that they don't bring value to a brand, or they don't deserve to be paid more than like a top racer is, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like at the end of the day, we're like marketing assets. And so like, if you can be valuable as like a marketing asset, it doesn't really matter if you're like really good or not that great. Like if you can appeal to an audience, I guess that's really like at the end of the day what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everyone's riding bikes.
Yeah.
As long as we're riding bikes and having fun on bikes. Exactly. And getting people to have fun on bikes. Like
that's enough, when you really break it down, it's like we're just riding grown up kids' toys. So like if you start to take things too serious, it's like, yeah, what are you doing trying to like take your life so serious? It's like you're just on a bike at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Which like a bike is such a powerful tool to like see the world, and to me it like means everything. Mm-hmm. But when you really break down, like me going out and going on like a training ride is not changing the world, you know? Like, I don't know. When you like really think about like the relevance of what you're doing, it's like you're not, it's not like you're fixing world hunger or like doing any, you know, I don't know. Maybe you're pulling somebody out of like a depressive state through like the stuff you're doing, and that's like, you know, if you can help one person,
yeah,
cool, maybe you're changing the world a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe sort of on that topic as it relates to content and just maybe how flooded content is these days, I feel like in the past you've made comments about like you want to make maybe more of like a YouTube push on your own,
yeah,
and wanting that content to be at a level or quality that does provide something to people, or it's like anti-vlog culture maybe, and like maybe why, what's your approach on or like thought on all of that? Because like there's people out there that just like hold a camera and talk about bikes and it like blows up, but like it sounds like for you that's not what you want to go with stuff. Like you've been doing, what are you calling like your hot laps, is that what?
Yeah, it's kind of like a PR push. That's kind of like the little series I've come up with.
But instead of it just being like, I'm Luca and I'm way faster than you and watch me try to go for a fast time, like you walk through your process of like, here's how I look at a section of trail and like, here's how I'm analyzing it. So there's like an aspect of how to it. And like, I don't know, like what's your thought on just like quality content these days and like maybe an importance to keep it at a certain level?
Yeah, I guess to me, there's like different tiers of like content that's like valuable. You have like your kind of day-to-day stuff, which to me is like the Instagram like stories or reels where it just kind of like, I don't know, just kind of like showcasing like some of your riding, and then like stage, so that would be like stage one. Stage two would maybe be like the YouTube stuff that's like a little more like maybe B-roll or slightly more filler, like not just super like heavy riding. And then stage three would be like that super kind of like produced content where like you're paying a filmer, you're maybe building something for it. So like trying to kind of hit all those different like tiers throughout a year, where like the day-to-day stuff is like the easy Instagram stuff. Stage two is like that YouTube content where there's like a little more relatability to it, and then the stage three would, yeah, like I said, like a little bit more of like the highly produced stuff. And so I think it's valuable to do like a bit of both. For me, like the push with, or I guess the deterrent from YouTube was always like, first off, it's like a ton of work. Like anybody who does like YouTube full time, which I do not, but like the dudes who do, like, I mean, even you guys do like so much with YouTube. Yeah, constantly.
It never ends. And it's once, like, you stop, no one cares, you know?
So, yeah. It's like such a grind. And, but then too, there's so much of it too. So I'm like, okay, I'm not going to make vlogs. Like that's not my thing. And so I was trying to think too. And then like another thing too, is like around here, there's like a lot of really fun riding, but a lot of it's like illegal. And I'm not trying to showcase like all these illegal trails and blow them up and like get spots shut down. It's like, okay, so legal content is out, or like illegal trails are out, and like vlogs are out. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to be doing more like enduro racing this year. And a lot of times you get maybe like one run on a trail and then you have to go like send a race run. And so I was like, I'll just go do that on like some of my local trails, or like maybe places that are somewhat local, but that I don't ride super frequently. And so I kind of give myself like this practice run where I break down like what I'm looking for, these different sections, and then I actually like will go back and like watch my run and then go for like a race run and try like a race run. Yeah. Like I'll just kind of like find a Strava segment and see like how fast I can go on like that Strava segment. But it's had like really good, I mean, I think I still have like under 1,000 subscribers, but like I think both the two videos I've done are at like over 3,000 views now, which isn't huge, but like for having under 1,000 subscribers, it's cool. Like people from around here are watching them, which like, I feel like you have to start local to like really build your audience.
Yeah. Yep.
And so like the people are stoked on them, 'cause they're like, oh, that's a trail I ride every day and I've never seen it ridden this way.
Mm-hmm.
And, so yeah, for me, it's like, I can go out, it can be like a training ride that I do, and then I can literally edit it in like maybe an hour. It's like super, it's pretty raw and uncut.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really just like putting in the effort to film it and like charge cameras and everything. And it's really not that much work. And it's not just like killing a day to go like session a jump or something that I'm just like not really doing. And I kind of have to go out of my way to do. So I guess it's kind of just been like a natural progression of like trying to race enduro. I'm trying to do more YouTube stuff. So it's kind of just like mash it into like one thing that can like benefit myself for like training purposes, and it can also benefit myself for like social media and like producing content.
Yeah.
Cool. Do you ever notice, let's say you have, you know, kind of the level three, like your high end project that's filmed well, it's produced well. Like it seems generally that those projects often get seen less or viewed less or shared less compared to the easy stuff. Does that ever, I don't know if the word, like, does it bum you out? Does it make you just not care about that stuff? I understand the brands probably want it, but I always joke that it seems like a lot of the times, like when we do stuff at Vital, like the less we try, the better it does.
Totally. Oh, know? Yeah.
Which sucks. That's like, because the there's some stuff you ever put your soul into. But yeah, do you notice that with what you do?
Totally. Yeah. I know. And it's a bummer too. Like you put, like you think like, oh, I'm putting a lot of effort into something like training. You're like, I put a lot of effort in, I'm going to see results.
Mm-hmm.
But for video, it's like not at all the case. Like just because you put a lot of effort in and you're riding well and you've created this like masterpiece, what you think is like a masterpiece of a video, it does not mean it's going to do well in terms of like viewership or engagement or whatever it may be. So yeah, it's definitely like saddening to see, but I guess it's also just like kind of like the reality that you have to, I guess, deal with like that kind of content these days.
Yeah.
Is like when you have dudes like Semenuk putting out like the heaviest edits of all time, and then you go out and do something which like you think you're stoked on, which like you should be stoked on, like if you're riding well in it and it's like produced well, but like just because you've put in the most amount of effort into it you can does not mean that like it's going to do well, which is, it's like definitely a bummer, but it's just kind of like, I guess, the way of the world. And
Yeah, for sure. It seems like there's some talk these days, you know, and I do it all the time, like, oh, you blame the algorithm. It's, you know, the algorithm's fault. But there are people coming back. I think that Mr. Beast dude is like, you know, the biggest YouTube person there is. He's like, okay, it may be the algorithm like throttling you, but the algorithm knows that no one wants to watch your video. Like there's a reason you're not getting shared. So it's like, you can blame the algorithm, but you should really be blaming yourself and what you're making.
For sure.
So
yeah. And just like, I think people a lot of times are like, I say in general, people are like scared of change.
Mm-hmm.
And so people that don't adapt like quickly to change are the people that are just going to be left behind, you know? And so like, if you're not willing to like adapt to some form of change, like you don't have to become a whole different person, but like, you just have to know that like things are changing and things are fluid. And like, just because, you know, Clay Porter made movies in 2007 that were like selling by covering like the World Cup doesn't mean you can plug that into 2023 and it's just going to do as well as it did then.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, like it's like a whole different world now of like content creation. And so I feel like the people that will be like the most successful are the people that are like not willing to change and to like, I guess, what am I trying to say? I guess like, yeah, hop on different trends as they're happening. Like you don't want to just like sell out and like start doing things that like aren't true to you, but you also need to like know that to stay relevant, you have to change in some ways. And like maybe you do things that you don't necessarily love all the time, but you know that they're going to like be good for you in the long run.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, it's like a constant, I don't know. Sometimes I'm just like, what am I even valuable for? You know, it's just like, you know, you get these people that are like these full-time YouTubers that are crushing it. And then you get these racers that are winning. And I'm just like, neither, kind of. I'm like, I'm not like a top racer. I'm not like a top YouTuber, but there's still,
it's a different value though.
Yeah. I guess it's a different value.
That's the way I think about it too, is it's like, you know, if you contract with, whether it's a brand that supports you or a brand you're just doing a project for, like it could get a ton of views. It could get no views. It could get a ton of engagement, get no engagement. But like at the end of the day, hopefully the main goal is that like they're stoked on what you produced for them or whatever, whatever like their goal was. I mean, maybe it was just, we want to hit 100,000 views. And like, that seems kind of tough, but you know, if the whole goal is say to like, create your, we were saying like your tier three, like your high production video. We want a really high production video that's going to like look awesome. Like probably the feedback, the goal isn't necessarily just a bunch of views. It's like, you know, X brand wants to have this like epic video that stands, you know, the test of time and like people talk about it or whatever, you know, like there's a bunch of videos that I'm watch or I can like think back on as like, that video is so sweet. And it probably didn't even do that well, but I like it for X, Y reason, you know? Yeah, and
totally.
I mean, kind of goes back to the whole like quality of content and like views and all that maybe aren't always priority.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of obscure. Like you're saying, like, we're always like, why did this hit so hard? And then this didn't, you know? And I don't know, like I'm more into trying to provide value. Like with what we do, it's like, I want to try to provide value and then hopefully like get people discussing something. Mm-hmm. But like, whether or not it gets a ton of views, it's like,
and there's a variety of audiences too. Totally. Like I can do a voiceover video about three new mountain bikes, more or less reading press releases, and it'll get 50,000 views. But then something we care about that we think is, you know, good for the core, that'll get 6,000 views.
Yeah.
But it's the 6,000 that count.
Yeah, you know? Totally. So exactly. Yeah, that's things. Kind of what I was thinking too, is it's like, just because you have, you know, like I have a there was like a video I posted on Instagram at one point that did like 1.3 million views.
Mm-hmm.
But like, just because it gets 1.3 million views doesn't mean you're going to sell 20 mountain bikes because of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But like you could do a video that gets maybe 2,000 views, but it's talking about like this mountain bike. And maybe out of that, two people are like, that Canyon's kind of sweet.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe I'll consider getting one or whatever it may be. So like, just because you have viewership does not mean that you're like selling product or like moving inventory.
Mm-hmm.
And that is too like a tricky thing to like how to like value yourself, is it's like, I guess that's maybe why social media is like so powerful in a way, is it's like you can directly show, oh, this year I did this amount of engagement, but still like you have that amount of engagement or viewership or whatever it may be. But that doesn't mean that because this year you had 2 million people engage on your account that you sold this much product. So like you could have people that have like great engagement, but they're not like moving product. And you can have people that have like less engagement, but maybe they have like a little tighter group of people, or like the way they're communicating with their audience is like more relatable. And those people may be selling like more product than other people.
Yeah.
So for sure. I don't know. It's just one of those weird things where it's like, it's so hard to like value yourself in like a certain way, because you don't really know at the end of the day, like, oh, I did this and it sold this. You're just kind of guessing.
Yeah. <you know? laughs> For sure.
Yeah. And we can delete it if it's not, you know, appropriate to talk about, but can you talk about when we see you in December, and like Kenda had a program that basically, like, if someone bought a tire and used your code, they're trying to measure basically like your influence on the brand. Is that something you can talk about?
Yeah, I feel like I can touch on it. I mean, like, that's another way of it's kind of like the same as like the social media, where like you can pull analytics from there. And like, yeah, so like as a Kenda athlete, we were like given these unique codes and asked to share them with our audience to try and get people to buy tires, which like totally makes sense. Like if I was following like a moto dude and I was trying to buy some Dunlops and they were 30% off, I'd be like, sweet, hell yeah. some good tires at like a discounted price. Like I'd be stoked. But like, I don't know, it's hard when like, maybe it's because I follow all these athletes. I feel like a lot of times that's like what I see, is just like people pushing these codes. I'm like, man, I'm just like that other dude pushing a code. And then, yeah, it just, sometimes it just feels like a bit forced. And I guess it's hard too, like maybe the stock's not there on like a certain tire you're trying to push or like whatever it may be. But like, yeah, for them, it's like, okay, well, at the end of the day, this is kind of this is like our year-end review, how many people used your code to buy tires? And for like a lot of people, it was like one or two people. There was like a few people that it was maybe like 20 or 30, which like is awesome. And then there was one dude that was like 200 or 300. And I was like, this dude's doing something. Like, is this dude working a bike shop and ordering these tires? Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't actually know the dude. I think it was like a gravel guy.
That's a good
guy.
Idea.
He's faking the system somehow. You know, something's going on there.
Yeah. So I guess, but it's like, it's tricky to like value your athletes in a certain way because like, you know, like Heather Munavi, she's like, she's been doing a lot more YouTube content. And so she has like this platform where I feel like she shows her face a lot more. She's like very good at engaging with her audience. And so for her, it's easier to kind of like, hey, use my code. And she's very, very, very good at kind of like presenting it in an organic way versus somebody like myself. I'm not like talking to the camera and being like, use my code to get this discount. I don't know. I just like,
I wouldn't have bought from you.
Yeah, exactly. But so like for her, it's awesome. Like her audience is really engaging well with her, like sharing this code and people are happy to like support the tire she's on, which like for Kenda and for herself is awesome. But like I've tested tires with Kenda in the past and helped them like produce good tires, you know, with like that booster. Like I helped them test that tire for like slalom. Like we had the Kenda dies come out and like, so like, I guess I could be valuable in a way where like, maybe I'm not getting as many people buying tires through this code, but I can help give product feedback. So like at the end of the day, you need like a well-rounded team, you know, you need somebody like,
for sure.
Yeah. Like Heather Munavi, who is like a sweetheart and awesome and like a ripping rider and is really good at like getting people to buy this code. But then at the end of the day, she's probably not helping develop like, you know, the top tier tire on the market, totally. You know?
Yep.
So like you need to have like a well-rounded group of people where like you can have, you know, somebody like Gwen when he was on the program, like really helping like put a like new, yeah, like test new product. And then like even like people like myself and Bubba and Kyle who can like test tires for different disciplines. And then obviously we can still kind of like share our code and hope people buy tires through them or whatever. But so yeah, I guess like, as a brand, I feel like you just need to be like as well-rounded as you can. So like, yeah, the code thing can be kind of like disheartening when at the end of the year, you see like, oh, one person used my code, sweet. But maybe you've like influenced somebody through whether it's like you yourself as like your own brand or maybe, yeah, this tire is a little bit better because you helped test it and make it a little better. And that, you know, like that helps sell tires. It's like, it's another one of those things. It's like really hard to like pinpoint why you're valuable as an athlete, which kind of comes back around to like, yeah, how do you value yourself? Right. It's like a hard thing.
There's not always a direct monetary path you can follow.
Yeah.
Like we have Luca and this is why, because he generates this many sales.
For sure.
But at the end of the day, like if there's not yourself or other riders helping develop a tire and then make a range of tires good, nobody, even with 30% off, isn't going to want to buy poor tires. You know what I mean? Like it all... they all work together.
Totally.
You need one. You can't have one without the other, sort of vibe.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Keep moving along.
Yeah.
I have two that sort of pertain to video photo guy Luca. What's like the coolest project you've been a part of or like created yourself? What are you the most stoked on that your name's on thus far?
I guess like as of recent, maybe like my most like dream project would have been like that Fox video I did with like Greg Minar. So like Heather and I, my girlfriend Heather Young and I flew out to Spain to shoot with Greg. This would have been like before the World Cup season started. And it wasn't like a whole new Fox 36 overhaul, but it was like a few new changes and they were kind of, I think, just mostly using it like as an excuse to film with Greg too. And so like we 2 years ago shot this video with Elliot Jackson actually here like locally and they were like stoked on it. Kind of just like shred it style, whatever, showcasing like the new 34. And so they essentially wanted us to come out and do like a similar video to that. And to me, like growing up, Greg Minar was like always an idol and he's kind of, he's become like a good friend as well. But so like getting the chance to like fly to Spain and shoot with this dude was like definitely a dream come true. And like we went out, had a couple scout days to kind of scout stuff. And then when we were shooting, it was like cloudy with like a little bit of rain every day. So like the conditions were perfect. We could wake up late because like the light was identical all day. It was just cloudy. And so we like, yeah, we pretty much just like pounded wine and shot a few days. And we ended up getting like an awesome video project out of it. And Greg was like, I think Greg was grateful too that I wasn't trying to waste the dude's time, you mm-hmm. know, like at the end of the day, it's like, it's a riding video and it's like, some people can get so like nitpicky on stuff. Mm-hmm. And for him, I'm like, dude, you got like way more things you need to worry about than like me getting my focus exactly perfect in this one mm-hmm. shot. You know, like you have a World Cup season coming up. Mm-hmm. You have like testing and stuff you need to be doing. And so I think he was grateful that we went out and scouted. We kind of had like these spots in mind we wanted to shoot. And we were very like quick about like, okay, let's get our shot and move on to the next spot. Let's mm-hmm. not just like try and get everything 100% like refined and perfect. Mm-hmm. To me, I'm like, if it's 80, 90% there, it's good enough. You know, a lot of times you're cutting into a shot yeah. anyways, where like you have a couple different angles. So like your focus doesn't have to be perfect all the way through. It can be, it can be good like halfway through the shot and then you switch to a different shot anyway. So like, it's not super important. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think just like getting the chance to shoot with Greg. Jordy was on the shoot too, which mm-hmm. is always fun.
Yeah.
Sean Estes, he was kind of like the producer who put it together. And we just had like such a good time, like hanging out in Spain. Went out to like some good dinners. Drank a ton of wine. You know, just things you do with Greg Menard.
Yeah. That's pretty sweet.
So yeah, that would be like one of the like highlight videos. Not necessarily like on a video side of things would be like my proudest in terms of like how I filmed it. I feel like mm-hmm. we shot like a killer video, but like we shot some like bike park stuff and maybe like the locations weren't like absolutely mesmerizing, but just getting the chance to shoot with Greg and hang out
yeah.
was like such a blast.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, I think Fox seemed to be stoked with the video and mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing too, like viewership wise, it did well. Sick. So like, it's always cool when like you shoot a video and people watch it, you know. It's disheartening when you put a lot of effort in, like just like we said earlier, yeah. you know, whether it's on like behind the lens or in front of the lens, like uh-huh. if you shoot a video and like people watch it and engage with it mm. and people like it and are commenting like directly about the video, it's like, oh sweet, cool.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, we're doing things that people like, so totally. That's good.
All right, last filming one. How much better is it filming for Kyle at Rampage versus digging for him?
Oh man, yeah. Like 900 times better. Not like, man, dig, those dudes dig. I feel so, yeah.
You have dug for him, right?
I have dug okay. for him, yeah. I dug for him in 2015, I believe.
Okay.
And that might be the hardest job I've ever done. Just like digging at Rampage is so gnarly. Hmm. And that was before we had like water plumbed in too, so we were having like carry water up. But regardless, like even now, it's like you're grinding for like almost 2 weeks. And like everybody's grinding. Like I grind from like the filming side of things, but I'm also not just like putting my body through hell every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, filming for Kyle Rampage is awesome. Like Kyle and I are good friends. And so I feel like a lot of the like appeal of those videos is it feels like it comes from somebody who is like close with him, mm-hmm. you know,
like on the inside.
Kind of on the inside, which mm-hmm. Kyle can kind of be hard to like break through like mm-hmm. that first wall with him. So like I think that's why the videos do well, is because we're just like buddies. And we also just run like whatever music we want, because we're not monetizing the videos.
Okay.
And so I'm just using music that like Kyle listens to.
Sweet.
And you know, it's like country music, which some people, it's like can be a polarizing topic. Sometimes there's some country music in there. But like at the end of the day, it's like we're just trying to create like this brand image for Kyle, which is like true to him. And mm-hmm. I'm not trying to create something that's like, you know, techno house music and like Rampage. It's like so not Kyle.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like trying to stay true to Kyle's image. And then we, the videos this year did really well. I think I was like adding up all the views from them, and it was like close to like 500,000 views for like those four videos.
Nice.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably helped a little bit that Kyle grenaded himself. Like obviously people love to see people just like, they don't love to see people crash, but like crash stuff always bumps up viewership, you know? I mean, look at like.
For sure. Like that story gets eaten up.
Yeah. And yeah. I guess too, it's just like. The fact that Kyle had competed at literally every single Rampage. Yeah. And then mm-hmm. this was the first one he had missed because of a crash, and mm-hmm. he broke his back. And it was just like,
yeah.
Yeah. I remember like, yeah. So it was like, he was testing this feature, the one he crashed on, which like, I'm sure people have seen, or if they haven't, it's like, yeah, it's on Kyle's YouTube. Has this big crash, like the heaviest crash I may have ever seen in person. And I just, yeah, I get down to him and he's just like, not in a good place. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, man, what has happened to this dude? And like, kind of starts to come to it, can move everything. I'm like, okay, good. It's like, he's not paralyzed, mm-hmm. but still I'm like, this dude, yeah, he's definitely out, you know? And then, yeah, he gets helied out, gets into surgery. Like, at least everything went as well as it could, considering like the damages he had. It seems like, but then too, he's like feeling bad. He's like, oh man, I let you guys down. Like, we did all this digging, I didn't even get to ride. And it's like, dude, I'm sure you feel that way because you have these people like helping you out, and like then you go grenade yourself. But like, that's Rampage, you know? Like, it's such a heavy thing, and like, you're having to test these things yourself, and like, yeah, crashes happen. And unfortunately this year it was like, it was kind of down to the wire for almost everyone. Like, a lot of people had these big builds, and like, people weren't getting them done almost till like the day of the event. So I think it was a mixture of like, well, obviously his like speed was a little off, the takeoff was a bit soft, and then he, I think, was just like, everything was a bit rushed too. Like, the build wasn't fully there. I think it could have been a little bit better. I think, yeah, he knows it could have been a little bit better. But that's kind of just like, sometimes how it goes. Sometimes you get away with it, sometimes you don't. And he got away with it for up until from 2001 till now. And
it's so crazy,
you know? Yeah. Unfortunately, it ended the way it did. But I think he's like excited to get back to it and be like, Rampage didn't defeat me. You know, like, I'm going to come back and I'm going to be able to like go out on a high and not just go out like, I'm the dude who like got, you know, defeated by Rampage.
Yeah.
So dude, it's heavy for sure.
Yeah.
But like, I think he for himself wants to be like, I need to go out and prove that like, I don't know. Yeah. He doesn't even have to prove anything, but I think he just wants for himself. He just wants to be like, yeah, I can, you know, I can move past this and I can end on a high instead of end on a low kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah. That's an gnarly event. That's a heavy event. But yeah.
Yeah.
Filming, I mean, filming your freaking buddy going down like he did is not fun, more mentally than physically. But like, yeah, filming is definitely better. Do you, if you're trying to get into Rampage, I highly recommend filming and not doing it. The payoffs are much better.
When I first started, like if someone got, if someone crashed, I would, you know, kind of jolt, turn the camera off and go see what's up. I've kind of trained myself to at least keep the camera on, unless, I don't know, it seems super terrible, but do you ever deal with that? Like thinking about like, oh, I should keep the camera on even though it's a stressful catastrophic event.
Like, I mean, when he had that crash, he had a GoPro on as well, which I like, I put on him, and then obviously I was filming. And yeah, initially for sure, the first thing I want to do is like turn the camera off and go run down to him and make sure he's okay. But like, there's also a whole medical team there. Then that's like what their job is.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah, I try to roll a little bit on it, but then I was like a full sprint down there to like see how he was doing. And then it's, yeah, somehow that GoPro like fell off his helmet too and just like perfectly rolled where he was like where it landed. And so that's, it was, it was pretty heavy seeing like, you know, I think Rachel was right there when it happened and she's just like yelling like medic. And it's just like so like kind of raw. So like, I think I cried like three or four times editing that video. Just like, because it's like one of those things where it's like you almost have to keep revisiting this thing that like you kind of want to move past, you know? And like, yeah, like I wanted to make the video as good as it could have been and like show people that like, you know, life goes on, but also just having to like revisit that instance, that like that crash that you're almost like trying to, you know, everybody's trying to move past is like, it's like a hard thing to do. So
yeah, that's heavy.
No way.
So yeah.
Should we pivot to something else?
Sure. We can
pivot. Let's do a little, some little lighter maybe. Okay, Kyle.
I'm getting towards the end of kind of my topics and stuff here, but maybe jumping back to Crankworks stuff. At Crankworks Whistler this year was the first time I've seen you in action at Crankworks event in a while. But the thing I was most fascinated by was the running around of, okay, I have practice for this event at this time, and then I have like 20 minutes to go get this bike set up or like move pedals, and then I got to go over and do pump track practice, and then I have like qualifying for this. And I was like, I'm never racing any Crankworks event. This is I'm like crawling out of my van, and you've like literally are getting back from doing stuff. And I'm like, it's like 7:30 in the morning, you know? Just maybe run people through what it's like to race multiple events at a Crankworks in a week.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It is for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Crankworks definitely stacks, like, I mean, they have a ton of events to get through, and a lot of times they're trying to run like live TV as well. So mm-hmm. I think for them, like the more days they have to have like production crews there, the more they're having to spend as well. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to get as many events as they can in a short amount of time, which a lot of times doesn't leave room for a ton of downtime, especially if you're doing multiple events.
Yeah.
So yeah, there'll be days where like maybe I have like slalom practice and qualifying in the morning, round of 32, and then there's a break, and then it's like there's no racing that night, but then you're going and doing like speed and style practice or pump track or whatever. So mm-hmm. there's a few days where like I think in Innsbruck this year there was slalom finals and pump track finals in the same day, mm-hmm. which like you're pretty much on your bike from like 7 a.m. to like 9-10 p.m. at night. So I mean, gnarly. There's breaks in between there, but for right. the most part, you're not taking breaks longer than 30 or 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like you're getting some food and then you're going and maybe you're working on a bike or you're taking your chain off your pump track bike.
Yeah. You're not laying
whatever.
Down.
Yeah. You're not just like hanging out doing nothing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess that just comes down to the fact that you just have to be like prepared for that stuff too, mm-hmm. like whether it's through your training or just trying to do like as much prep work as you can. Luckily for me too, a lot of my bikes share parts. So like if I have something break on one bike, mm-hmm. I can kind of just rob it off another bike, at least temporarily, you know,
yeah.
like I bust a brake or whatever. I can just pull it off my other bike mm-hmm. and it's like goes straight on or like drivetrain or whatever it may be. So mm-hmm. that I think also makes it easier. The fact that like a lot of my bikes share parts. So mm-hmm. it makes like sometimes transitioning from one event to the other easy.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just like trying to streamline things like as an athlete and just like give yourself the best chance for success. Mm-hmm. But I kind of strive in like the chaos of it all. Okay. Or like I kind of enjoy the chaos of it all.
That's good.
Do people ask you to do film projects like, you know, Media Luca at Crankworks, and are you just there as an athlete? Like did you ever try to mix the two?
If anything, I'll try and like Heather and I a couple of years ago did like a video during Crankworks of me, but she was obviously like filming it and stuff. Mm-hmm. So some of it will be more like producing work, where I'm like trying to produce a piece and have somebody else do it. If not, it's just like, I'm just doing GoPro stuff, mm-hmm. which like a lot of times, like the GoPro stuff is kind of I really enjoy the perspective of like a GoPro when you're racing, because it's like the most raw perspective mm-hmm. you can get. Mm-hmm. So like I try and just do like my own, like the tier one stuff, you know, like the day-to-day stuff of like the GoPro. Yeah. And I almost try and like be the first person, like I'm kind of making my goal to be like the first GoPro up.
Yeah. So, I think that's a huge part of success with all this stuff.
Yeah.
And someone like Bernard, I think he's really good at that with his World Cup stuff.
Totally. Yeah. Where he's like pumping out videos throughout the weekend kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to almost like do a practice run, download my GoPro, do a quick little edit on it, get the colors looking good, maybe either just post it up raw or just like find a song to go with it and just go like straight up. Because people are like, you know, like that event's like very, you know, like people are following this event, and so they want to see stuff coming out of it. I know like when I'm at home, I'm like hitting refresh, just waiting for Vital Raw to come on for the World Cup.
World Cup day, yeah. That's the best part of this job, is that I get the Raw from Lawler before anyone else sees it. That always makes me stoked.
Yeah. But so yeah, I guess like when you have a lot of like hype around an event and people are kind of like almost waiting to see stuff. So like if you can be the first person there, it's like you have kind of the best chance for success. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I think Bernard, I don't know if he mentioned it specifically, but he was, I don't know if it was a track walk or something, but Sven was in it and Sven cursed, mm-hmm. and Bernard's trying to keep curses out of it. And I think Bernard's goal is literally just edit with his GoPro, like start, stop, start, stop.
Totally.
Yeah. Slap them in, export it, and be done, like no edits, you know? So it's like, yeah, it's literally a race.
Totally. Yeah. 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 And I was talking to him briefly about it this year in Canada too. And he's like, man, dude, I pretty much, all I have to do is, yeah, like what you said, do exactly that. And he's making like money off of YouTube from it too.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, why would I not do it? It's bringing in like extra income and like,
not to mention the value to the people he's working with.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. Yep. Especially the kids too. Like probably a lot of the people are going to recognize somebody like Bernard, maybe even over like Greg, because you know, they're watching YouTube and they're seeing his vlogs or whatever, you know, his, what does he call them? LSDs or whatever.
Yeah, it is.
Lifestyle LSDs. Documentaries.
Lifestyle documentaries.
Yeah. I don't know why that's hard to remember sometimes.
But yeah, so like even from like an engagement and like people like recognizing him, like, yeah, just the fact that he's doing that, it's like boosting his brand that he's creating as well. So
yeah, and his practice videos, like he puts every GoPro lap from practice mm-hmm. into his video. Like mm-hmm. you'll see him like 38 minutes. Like, dude, what are you doing? Oh, it's every run you do.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's freaking totally. Awesome to yeah. see him progress and see him stop, talk to people, and then haul significant ass like by the time it's his last practice run. Like, I love it. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. I'm stuck to true, right?
We've got to phone a friend from Hart because Jensen USA knows that riding the trail with friends is better than riding alone. So we've got something coming in from one of Luca's friends slash bosses slash
Mr. Shart.
Yeah. Well, that's his email. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see.
It's going to be really loud.
All right, Spomer.
All right,
I'm phoning in from your abandoned home, the beach, with a few questions for Luca Cometti. Question number one, Luca, what is the message that you would like to send to the Suron owners of the world? And two, how much do you think Spomer's missing this location I'm at? Actually, third question, bonus question. Can you rate these conditions behind me? Because I don't know what I'm looking at in the water. From Velo Solutions Pump Track to Whistler Bike Park. What do we got back here? And also, I can't tell, but did you see the guy on the hydrofoily thing? Second bonus question. What is that apparatus?
Dude, e-hydrofoil?
Wow.
I can already tell the conditions funny. Are way worse than Velo Solutions Pump Track.
But probably. Okay.
Man, that question had layers.
Yeah. That's Scott, though. Dude.
One question,
he's
please.
Like me. He's like, I mean, you can probably tell from this last whatever hour and a half 2 hours we've been going, I just bounce all over, and he also bounces all over.
No way, it's awesome.
I feel like everybody in mountain biking is just some form of like functioning ADHD. So
yes,
so yeah, Suron owners, don't ride your bikes on BMX or mountain bike jumps. They're not for you. Build your own stuff.
That's a big deal around here, huh?
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. like there's a local dirt jump spot called Regency. I haven't been there in person, but I just keep seeing photos of like all these like just punk Suron kids who I'm pretty sure have just never been told like no in their life. And they're just given this like device that's essentially a motorcycle that you can't hear. And they're just going and thinking like, oh, just because it's public property and like mm-hmm. just because it's a public property, we are allowed to ride our things here, which like you're not technically wrong, but also like on like morally you're wrong for sure. You know, it like yeah, I don't know, I think it's just like these entitled like little shit kids from Orange County that like mm-hmm. have never been told no, and then yeah, they just go out and do whatever they want. And it's unfortunate because it's like really compromising like a lot of spots, and like there's been injuries because of it. Like out at San Clemente, this wasn't even a kid, this was like a full-blown adult. He like ran into somebody head-on and like broke their jaw. So it's,
oh really?
Yeah, it's just
is
like
this a place that's like a dog park or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was a dog park maybe like a year ago now. It was a while ago now, but like, yeah, it's like there's a reason that like motos don't ride out at these spots.
Mm-hmm.
But then you take away the reason that the main reason that motos don't ride, and it's because of noise and being scared that you're going to get the cops called on you. And now you have like essentially the same device. And if you're going and riding it like up mountain bike trails, you're creating like a whole new hazard by like potentially having these like head-on collisions. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that too, it's just like motorcycles, they're like more destructive to like terrain. So if you're going and like hand shaping stuff that's built for like one thing, and then you go ride this other more powerful thing on it, like mm-hmm. a lot of times it tears things up too. And like nothing, I'm not trying to like bash on Surons themselves, like they're a blast, like I've ridden one and they're mm-hmm. like a blast to ride. It's just like people just need to like be respectful, I guess.
Yeah.
You know,
for like, sure. Like, I mean, at
just have respect.
BMX mountain bike trails, like you don't ride with super knobby tires.
Yeah.
Same reason.
And you water right? before you ride. Like yeah. there's mm-hmm. just like certain rules that like, I think these, well, first off, a lot of it is just like these little kids who are like probably having this like teenage rage. And it's just probably, I think it's also just like this new generation of kids that are just like, they're just kind of clout chasing. They're just mm-hmm. like chasing these like Instagram views, and they don't really care who's like standing in their way.
Yeah.
They don't really understand like negative consequences because they haven't had to like work really for anything in their life.
Mm-hmm. It's just being young, I guess.
Just being young, which like I was definitely put in my place when I was younger with things. Like I remember getting like cocky with stuff in the past and friends being like, hey, we're not gonna be a friend anymore if you keep it up. I'm like, whoa, okay, there's consequences. Yeah, I need to change, you
totally
know? So like maybe these kids have just never been told that they need to like do something different.
Mm-hmm. It's a different, seems like a different space and time we're sort of in. Because I can think back on like skate park etiquette. Mm-hmm. And like if you go to the skate park and you drop in, you're like a little kid, you're like, that was super fun. You go back to the top, you're like, I'm just going to do it again.
Yeah.
And then you have the older individual there who like steers you straight of like, hey man, I'm going to go. And you get in the back of the line. And like simple things like that where I'm not going to stand there and be like, well, this is a public skate park and I can go whenever I want.
Exactly.
Right. It's like, it's well, like sure, safe, you could.
Elements to it, you know?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's like you could do that, but like, it's for everybody to enjoy, you know? Yeah. And like, same, like with dirt jumps, it's like, you know, A, somebody put a bunch of time into it. B, we wanted to last time, like stand up for a while so that we all can continue to enjoy it. And if you want to go, you know, if you have a Suron, like you can come back with a bicycle. We're not saying don't come here,
mm-hmm.
you know, but like, let's be realistic. Like this device does significantly more damage than what they are intended for. And
yeah,
it's a weird, like the, cause our buddy John had this happen at a set of jumps and like, it was just like the classic, like middle school mentality of like, you're telling me no, I'm just going to come back here and destroy it then.
Yeah.
Because you can't tell me no. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you're not 18, so we can't like hit you, you know? But like if this, if you were 18, like
Jason somebody doesn't hit children, everybody.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Let the record show. I don't hit kids. but you know, like it's kind of unfortunate. We're like in a place where I don't know, like when I grew up, like if there was older kids at like the dirt jump spot, I was terrified of them and I listened to them and like,
sure.
because they probably would have chased me or they probably would have pushed me over. Like nowadays there's clearly none of that. And I don't know. Yeah. It's a bummer for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it just needs to come down to like mutual respect.
Totally.
And like, mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of these issues are from kids who just don't get it, but mm-hmm. it'd be nice if they at least, like you said, listened a bit more and like,
yeah.
But then also like sometimes it's easy to come to them just like too hot. And then they just almost want to like,
yeah, they want the confrontation almost.
They want the confrontation almost instead of just be, like coming to them as like a human being again, which like I'm not saying that I've come to people always in like the most level-headed way. But mm-hmm. like really where you're going to make the most change is like coming to these people in like a level-headed way and just having a conversation like, hey, I know you're probably new to this and like you don't really understand exactly why this is an issue, but these are the reasons why. And like people had to tell me this when I was your age about like what I was doing, you know, and it just like, you may think you're not doing anything wrong, but like you have like, there's way more consequence to your actions than what you may ever know, you know?
Yeah.
And this? There's like a lot of work that's been done either to make a spot a certain way or to like have bicycles be allowed that you're essentially going to get ruined for everyone because of like what you're doing with your new thing that people are still trying to figure out what to do with them. Kind of, you know,
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
what was the second question or third or fourth?
Something about the surf or
like, oh wait, I think it was it something about you? Was it, had to, did it relate
like,
to you?
Yeah, he tried to ask that the other day about me missing the ocean so much, and I don't know what he's digging into.
Oh, probably
like, yes, I miss the ocean. I wish I lived here and could surf Salt Creek all day, but I can't because I live in Idaho. So there you go, hard. Is that good enough?
But he wanted you to rate the conditions from Velo Solutions to Whistler Bike Park.
Oh,
what does that even
mean? I'm like assuming of the surf.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Velo Solutions.
Is he saying that like Velo Solutions is like a 1 and Whistler Bike Park's a 10?
That's
like,
what
is
I wondered. That, yeah.
Like Scott Hart hate.
I mean,
hate
it depends
tracks?
On the trail you're on. If you're on a certain trail at Whistler, that may be a 1 and Velo Solutions may be a 10.
It's very true. Depending on the time of the year and
Blue Velvet during Crankworks, like that's a 1. That's
it's true. Those conditions looked terrible.
They didn't look that great. It was like
it's windy and cold here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well today it seemed kind of like the wind was blowing offshore, which is usually pretty good for surf. Yesterday it was like full onshore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Weather's been kind of all over the place.
T-Sage, the waves did look crazy this morning.
T-Sage said he scored this morning. He's like, Blackies went off, where were you? So I was here, unfortunately, but that's okay.
Yeah.
He asked about a foil.
Oh, is that what he asked about?
An e-hydrofoil? That's like a Suron.
Oh man, actually, this
Suron of the
sea. Yeah, dude, I went Suron surfing this summer with Kevin Walsh up in Washington. He's
dude,
got like two e-foiling? Of those e-foils
because
he lives like on the bay or whatever, like in an inlet, so there's no waves there.
Yeah,
like,
that would be pretty fun.
Yeah, he's got like these two e-foils, and
are they hard? Like, is it?
They're hard at first, yeah, but then it literally just feels like you're Jesus walking on water. Like, you're just
because you just stand
the water,
there, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah,
and you have this like control in your hand,
and there's no bumps because the foil's underwater. Like, if there was chop, you just cruise right
through
it. Yeah,
yeah, but those foils are definitely like a lethal weapon.
Yeah.
At like surf breaks. Or they can be under the wrong person.
Yeah.
But they also, I would love to have one. They look like less. So I'm down with foiling. Scart. 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 Let's go foil.
Let's go foil.
Sweet. My last question is just, what do you got going on for 2023? Like, I think you've mentioned you have plans to try to race enduros more.
Yeah, so I'm signed up for all the BMEs except the, what is the Utah one? Not Park City. What's the Brian Head?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because okay. That's during Whistler Crankworks. I still want to go to Whistler Crankworks, but I'm kind of stepping away from like more of the Crankworks stuff. Partially because it just goes back to like flying to Europe with three bikes is a freaking nightmare. And I just like when I come home, all I do is ride my trail bike and I like love riding my trail bike. And so, yeah, I think it's kind of just been like the natural progression of like my riding is it's like the geometry I'm pretty sure of like the bike I'll be racing this year is like almost identical to the geometry of like the M16 that I had like the most success on. Uh-huh. So I think I was always like so against enduro. I was like, oh, just mountain biking, whatever. Mm-hmm. But now it's just like, that's like the most fun form of mountain biking for me. And even like slalom, it started to feel like, I'll definitely still do some slalom racing, but like training for slalom is like kind of repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going out and building new slalom tracks every day.
Yeah.
And there's not just like hundreds of slalom tracks around the world.
Totally. It's close to whatever, BMX
around
a
here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like enduro is just one of those things where first off, it's like that series follows a bunch of places I've never been that I've always wanted to go to.
Yep.
Like I've always gone to go like Montana, like some other spots in Colorado, mm-hmm. Whatever, even like a few spots in Arizona. Like, I don't know. It's cool that they're going to some spots I've never been to, which I'm excited for.
Is the Missouri one on again?
No, this year it's like Mount Nebo, Arkansas, I think is like the replacement for it.
Okay.
Huh. So interesting. That'll be like the first one. And then, yeah, there's Colorado, Montana, Arizona. And then, yeah, Utah, which I won't go to. But yeah, just trying something new. I guess was starting to feel like a little bit burnt out on like the crank work stuff and just all like the travel that comes with it. Not that there's a ton of travel, but like when you do travel, it's like,
yeah, it's full on.
You have like, to go far, like dude, New Zealand and then Europe.
Yeah,
and everything.
People look you like you have six eyes when you're in the airport with two bike bags, a wheel bag, like gear bag. You know, just like it's chaos trying to fly to Europe with all those bikes and trying to get them in a little mini rental car. So just just like staying stateside a little more, having some bigger day on the bikes, just like everything about enduro is kind of like starting to become more appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm like even thinking, I still have a downhill bike, but I'm like, I think I might sell a downhill bike.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I just never ride it anymore. Ride it.
Yeah.
Like I went to Innsbruck last year for Crankworks and I raced downhill and I was like three practice runs in and I was like, I'm not even enjoying this anymore. I think it's just like the fact that I never ride it around here. It's like the trails have been the same too for downhill.
Mm-hmm.
You pretty much just like sit in a car 5 or 6 hours to ride like 10, 15 minutes throughout the day.
Yeah. You can pedal 2 laps on any given trail we would shuttle, or you could like shuttle 6 laps in a day. Cause nothing around here is like the most efficient setup.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, just like spending more time on the bike and just like getting to see some new spots is kind of like my main draw to it. And so, yeah, I'm trying to like train for enduro this year and just hopefully do some like more of that like YouTube content around some of the races and just kind of like take it as like a learning year and see where it goes.
Yeah.
Cool. Maybe I just hate it after the end of the year. Maybe I enjoy it and want to do it again and try and do some like EDRs in the future or...
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I love that you called it EDRs.
So yeah.
I guess that's the future, right? We gotta adapt, dude. Let's change it.
Oh, I appreciate it because I feel like you've done a good job of not just sitting somewhere where you're like bummed on it. Like downhill racing, you know, you kind of did the thing and you're like, it's not really feeling like the right vibe for me. Like I'm gonna move to doing Crankworks events. Mm-hmm. And then kind of sounds like sort of in like an in-between right now. You're like, I'll dabble in both, but like, let's make it fresh again.
Yeah.
Which is sick, you know, like I think a lot of people or a lot of racers just like are bummed and just stay doing what they do, and it's like you're not getting creative or, you know, or like looking around maybe.
Yeah, I think in just like so many aspects of my life too, I'm just like such a spaz and always wanting to do like new things and try different things out. Mm-hmm. And so I think like I've like always loved biking partially because of the fact that there's so many different disciplines you can do with it. Whether it's like road biking, cyclocross, you know, there's like so many things you can do under like the wheelhouse of a bicycle.
Yeah.
So like just having the yeah, I guess like the curiosity to just like try new things has always kept me like excited to, whether it be like train for it or just like put effort into trying to do good at it.
Yeah.
And I also too am like super envious of the people who can just be like 7 years into privateer life and then like the eighth year they finally get a World Cup ride and they start doing well, you know, like I'm so respectful of people who can just like grind through the dark years and like come away on top. Like Dakota Norton in a way did a lot of that. I remember like traveling with Dakota when he was like on a Morpheus and just like
the fact he made it out and he had years on a Morpheus.
Yeah.
That alone's legendary.
But like that, I remember like, sitting like three wide in the front of a van with Dakota, like rental van, just like driving to races together, like in Europe, and him just being like, having like stuff happening at home with like his mom and whatever, maybe like personal stuff, and then like trying to do well. And like, just, you know, I come from like a way better background, let's say like privileged in a way background than he does. You know, he comes from like a way gnarlier background. And so like, I in some ways like envy the like grit that he's developed from like that background and like the push. And like now he's like absolutely crushing it. And it's so cool to see.
Versus
like, maybe I lack a little bit of that like grit or like perseverance to like stick with something because maybe the way I was raised a bit or whatever, maybe personality or, but I totally like respect the people who can just like stick to something and like go for it. I think it's so cool.
Totally.
Interesting.
I don't got that.
Yeah.
All right. We got one more cause Hart just texted again. Final question.
Is he still at the beach?
Or this is just a text only. So final question. So the UCI designates an official world championship for pump track and even esports, parentheses, riding a trainer, but not dual slalom. What is it going to take for mountain biking's most important competitive event to be officially recognized by its governing body?
Man, I didn't even know about the esports thing, but it kind of makes sense. Like, like a Zwift, whatever.
Is that
like
what he means? Is that what it is?
Oh yeah, like there's.
Yeah.
I think
I didn't even know about that.
I think I actually posted in the forum, but the press release for esports national champs came out with all the details, but we don't know when downhill national champs is.
Oh, nice. Like,
so that's their priority, dude. You get on a Zwift and you basically pump out watts or do whatever. There's tons
in your living room rules.
Yeah, there's
so tons. You can be wherever though.
Yep.
Kind of makes sense.
Does it? I don't
know. I mean, it's like Formula E or whatever, like online Formula One racing. It's kind of like that.
I mean, it's like professional video gaming, I guess.
Whatever.
Yeah.
The way
I'm gonna get a lot of hate for that.
All right, so
how
do you get dual slalom recognized by UCI, USAC, whoever?
Well, I will say, like, while I'm not the hugest fan of like USA cycling for a lot of things, I am grateful that they still have national champs for dual slalom.
Yeah. Like that's like awesome. The only event, like sanctioned event for slalom is national champs, right?
Yeah. I think, I don't know. World champs for slalom would be freaking sweet.
It would be.
And maybe Red Bull lost downhill. Come on, Red Bull, pick up some slalom racing. Yeah. You know, people love racing slalom. It's like that's a cool thing about slalom too. It's like you literally need, I mean, Rotorua did it on like 40 feet of drop for the whole trail, you know?
Yeah.
Like you can almost have slalom be one of those events where you can bring it anywhere. It's kind of like pump track, you know? Like you can build a slalom track just about anywhere.
Yeah.
You could have find a place in Kansas to do a slalom race, I'm sure, you know?
Definitely.
There's probably a 30, 40 foot hill in Kansas.
Hart's from Indiana and he's the biggest fan there. So exactly. There you go. Yeah. We did single slalom World Championships of America at Deer Valley in 2006, probably before you guys were born, but just saying, we tried way back then.
Yeah, I would love to see some sort of slalom world champs. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Red Bull, I'm sure you're listening right now. It happen.
I don't want to be the dick at the end of the podcast here, but slalom's kind of a grind by the time you get to the dope end of the show. Like getting everyone back up and then takes two runs. Like it slows down at the end. And I think that's the hardest part for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
You need to have
have a solution.
You need to have the KTM kids race right in the middle of it or something right at the end.
There you go.
Suron race.
Yeah, the Suron race down the slalom track. The Stay Sick kids race before like the finals race. I don't know. I think there'd be a way to, like you said, it does kind of slow down, but I don't know.
Yeah, you could.
If you had the right promoter or whatever, you could,
find a way
to make it
move along. Yeah.
I think that's all I got.
Yeah, man. Cool. Thanks. That was super fun.
We covered a bunch of topics.
Yeah. Guess the time.
That was fun. I'm going to go.
It's always longer.
2 hours and 15 minutes.
Dude, you have a good gauge of time. 2 hours and 5 minutes.
Oh, okay. Mm, cool.
Nice. All
right.
Solid. All
right. Sweet.
Thanks
for having me on. Thanks if you made it to the end of the podcast for listening.
Yeah.
I'm sure plenty of people did.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
A big shout out goes to Maxxis Tires, Jensen USA, and Fox Shocks for supporting the Inside Line.